Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It's 420. 420, man.
Yeah. Day two. Do your taxes! It's due today! But don't worry, if you wait until today, you're still solid. You still got a little time left to get them in without the IRS being angry with you. Right, Nick?
Tax day was this Monday, Chris.
Ah, shit.
Man. You can still actually turn your taxes a little bit late. I did it once, and no one ever actually followed up with me. Sometimes you can get away with it, sometimes you can't. I would not risk it personally. Anyhow, Chris, I don't want us to get off on too long of a tangent, because we have a guest here, and so we shouldn't keep her waiting. Hello. But I did want to mention that I listened to the Super Larios Brothers podcast. I listened to a couple of episodes of that, of the recent ones you guys did.
Okay.
Your brother has terrible opinions when it comes to superhero works, doesn't he? I'm sorry, Daredevil Season 2 was not good.
I still like Season 2 of Daredevil.
Some parts of it are great.
Everything involving Punisher I thought was great.
Oh, yeah. I like that stuff.
See, like, the stuff I'm not crazy about.
It is just it did kind of make me think, though, you know, you've got a relationship with your brother where you can have very, strong disagreements on certain things, but, you know, your brothers, and you get along normally anyway. Whereas we met each other because our interests and likes are so close to each other, so a lot of time we do actually agree on stuff. But that's fine because, you know, occasionally we can get a third person on the podcast to talk about stuff with. And actually it's kind of funny because this is completely unrelated, and this is a big tangent. You had a conversation in there about Charlie Cox's age at one point on that podcast. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned that Foggy looks way too old to be fresh out of college. Do you know what Foggy did what Foggy's actor did in the 90s?
Pornography.
No.
Damn.
Almost the exact opposite. He was, what was his name? Fulton Reed. In the Mighty Ducks franchise. Disney Mighty Ducks franchise.
Wow.
The big kid who had the killer slap shot. That's Foggy.
Yeah, it's hard to sell him as like, hey, I'm this fresh out of law school 28-year-old.
He's like 38 in real life.
Yeah.
So I thought that was crazy when I found that. It's weird that he's, like, one of, like, three actors who were kids in, you know, that series who has continued on doing stuff. One of the others being fucking Kenan Thompson.
He just doesn't stop.
Really?
He's, like, the sole force keeping sketch comedy alive out there.
Pretty much. So I wanted to bring that up because you reminded me of that. Yeah. He was doing Disney before Marvel fell under Disney umbrellas. There you go. Anyhow.
I want to bring up something real quick. I don't want to hold up Annalisa too long.
Oh, you gave away the special guest. No one would ever suspect it would be Annalisa.
But I do have a follow-up, Nick, to something we brought up last week. I mentioned at the time we were the 125th best hobby podcast according to iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got ahead of ourselves, Nick.
Oh,
We're too brazen. We have dropped off the list completely of iTunes 200 Best Hobby Podcasts. Like Icarus, we flew too close to the sun, and it exposed our Achilles heel. And then a Trojan horse came in, and it brought with us Zeus, who turned us into a woman so that we could have sex to prove which gender enjoyed sex more, and then someone became a goose. The point is, we're not on the list anymore, Nick. And I think it was hubris that got in our way.
We flew too close to the 125th furthest closest star to the Earth. Which, when you think about it, that's like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent of a percent closer than we would have had to blow in order to get close, too close to. So, yeah, that's a shame.
Dreams were nice to have, though. For a little bit, it was nice to have it.
We're going to have to put that up like on our list of accomplishments for the podcast. for 1 week was the 125th most popular hobby podcast.
It was for a week. It was for like 2 hours. By the time the podcast ended, we were dropped like 13 spots.
Heard you were getting a bit full of yourself. Well, we here at Apple think that you need to remember your place.
I don't understand
how... Bring in 75 more woodworking podcasts ahead of them.
I don't understand how Apple does its algorithm. Like, how can we change, like, 13 hobbies podcast spot in the span of 2 hours? What's happening? They're like, well, that's when all the yarn podcasts come out. Wednesday night at 7:30. What, are you crazy? You can't compete with knitting and crochet.
Oh, boy. So
Annalisa!
Yeah, Annalisa is here.
Hello, hello.
How have you been for the last couple of months? Busy, from what I understand.
Busy, yeah. On the upside, though, there's a lot of good manga coming out.
Oh, yeah?
That's good. So,
that's
but it makes good. You very busy.
Yeah.
Ties up your time.
Yeah.
You still have time to work on World Trigger, though, don't you?
Of course! It's number one.
Do you even consider World Trigger work at this point, or is it just so much, like, excited jubilation that you just, you finish it, you're just like, oh, now I have to go back to work?
Well, the weekly chapters, I've been doing it long enough now that the weekly chapters take almost no time, and it's just like, yeah, this is great, oh, I love this series, and then, yeah, when I finish that, it is... Okay, back to whatever book I'm working on. But if I'm putting the sound effects out on the actual book, depending on the scene, it's a lot of cussing. Like...
It won't trigger? Like, is that the sound that triggers make when they fire? Like, fuck!
I recently did the rank war with Susanari 1 and Nasu, which is in the storm. They're just, Jesus fuck, stop blowing up the bridge! Stop fighting in a town! I have to redraw the entire building! Now I just finished the Ninomiya Azuma Kagero one, which is in the snow, which isn't quite as bad, but they're in a freaking building for part of it, and I have to redraw the building! And...
But you get to look at Ninomiya the entire time. and draw his stupid squad's lame outfits with like a business suit with
we
stupid
have
holsters.
Sort of tuxedos on.
Have you heard his little blurb? Every volume has little blurbs about characters sometimes.
Yeah, at the end. I haven't gotten to Ninomiya's yet.
So Ninomiya's spoilers is he designed the uniform that his squad wears because he didn't want to be seen as cosplay like all the others, but in doing so, he looks like, his squad looks like they're cosplaying the most compared to the rest.
They do, because everyone else, they're like in uniforms. This one's like Ninomiya in a fucking like business suit. And the other two guys also in business suits, but they're like, hey, we can't make these guys look as cool as the main guy, so they'll just have holsters built into their outfit on the side. You know, like, make it stand out that they're not actually that cool.
See, that description just sums up Ninomiya so much to me.
Maybe
like,
Ninomiya was like, he wanted to look super professional, but the others in his squad are like, but wouldn't it look cool if we had these holsters? And he's like, fine, you can have them. And they thought that they were super cool, but they were actually super lame, because sometimes teenagers have terrible taste.
And he just turns to him and he's like, I miss you so much, Hatohara. Please save me from these losers.
Oh, boy. So, we have a special manga we're talking about this week. We took a comedy suggestion, because... April is Comedy Month here in Weekly Manga Recap. And the series that we took is Hinamatsuri, which its name comes from a festival in Japan, which I was completely unfamiliar with, and I don't think I learned anything about it reading this manga, but that's okay. It's mostly just a pun on the fact that the main girl's name is Hina. So, it's about this gangster, this Yakuza member named Mita, and... he's chilling out at home one day, and all of a sudden, this pod just appears in his apartment. And there's a little girl stuck in the pod. And he decides to let her out, and it turns out she has insane, super powerful Esper powers. She has psychic abilities. And it's about how he basically tries to balance now having to look after this 13-year-old girl with super psychic powers while continuing to be a Yakuza. And that's the setup, basically. The rest of it is very sitcom-y.
Sure.
Mostly revolving around Hina being a little shit.
initially seemed like it was going to be a bit of a gag manga, because the premise is out there. Like, it's completely nonsensical. It's just, like, gangsters in an apartment, this fucking pot shows up, bangs him on the head, little psychic girl comes out, and she's like, I'm gonna live with you now, and psychically threaten you if you try to do otherwise. And you're like, well, this is kind of weird and out there, and, like, a lot of the humor's a little nonsensical. But by, like, 10 or so chapters into it, they've built a cast, and it becomes a lot more of a sitcom. Like, even her psychic powers stop being the focal element for a while. It starts being the fact that she's just a strange girl who's living with this gangster guy, and I was a little concerned at first. I was like, uh-oh, it's another unconventional male adult who's taken on a very young girl to be to act as a daughter to him. This can either go one of two ways.
Either it will end badly, or it won't.
Yeah. Either I'm going to hear Nick screaming from Florida, or I can assume that this one does not end with those two getting together.
Well, it's not over yet. The series is still ongoing. So, and there has been a time skip, so she's aged up. So, danger, warning signs. Sirens going off. Time skips are always a bad sign when it comes to these types of series. Based off of the one time that it had a time skip, and it ended badly.
So it's 100%, like, certainty at this
point. One for one is still 100%.
Yeah, it's guaranteed to happen. It's the statistics say.
This one will break the streak of one. Exactly. As you say, the psychic powers, Pina's psychic powers really only kind of come up when it's convenient, really, for the series. Occasionally, you know, she will use her powers to beat up Nita when she's not getting her way and she's frustrated with him. You know, just as a little reminder of, oh, right, even if Nita does occasionally get really pissed off at Hina because she's a useless, home-wrecking slob, then he can't get rid of her. He gets very close to getting rid of her at one point, and then, even without the threat of psychic powers, literally every other character in the cast is like, why did you do that? Take her back in. What about that other psychic girl I threw on the street? Well, we don't know about her. So she's going to make me cry some more.
She's found peace with the homeless people of the city.
For a sitcom, this series has some elements that really made me feel incredibly sad.
Well, that's kind of the weird thing, because as a sitcom, it works.
Well, some sitcoms do make me sad, but
yeah, like, that's the big advantage, I think, of a series like this that flows a bit more like a sitcom, is that it has character development to kind of fill in the parts where it's not just, you know, a barrage of jokes to fill you in, you know, in a chapter per chapter or even a page by page basis in some series. You get time to actually get to know these characters. There is a side character who is Anzu, another psychic girl, who basically, like, loses a duel against Hina. And from thence forward, it's like, well, you can't use your powers here anymore. And then she gets stuck on Earth, and she has nowhere to go, so she becomes homeless. And there's an entire chapter of her getting initiated into a homeless society. And there's still a little humor in it, like, very dark
humor. Oh, is it?
Like, a dark humor and things like that. But it's, like, a very emotional, like, there's legitimate emotional beats in the series about, like, how all the old men in the homeless society welcome her in, you know, begrudgingly at first, but then they kind of realize that she reminds many of them of, like, grandchildren or nieces that some of them had. You're like, oh, this is kind of sad. She, like, learns the value of a dollar and hard work and has made happiness and peace with this kind of simplistic life. Like, it's strange, it's amusing, but it's almost odd, because I, like, after the first couple chapters, I just assumed it would be a series of nothing but, like, slapstick, I'm going to psychically force this man down a flight of stairs because fuck him sort of series.
It's, I think the series is really at its best when it just goes for the more dramatic elements, when it goes for, you know, character development and stuff like that. Because for as strange a series as this can be, I honestly did not find it to be very funny a lot of the time. It's weird. Some of the jokes that the series puts out are not particularly funny. I mean, yeah, that's going to happen. If you tell enough jokes, then some of them aren't going to be as funny as others. But the unfunny jokes that the series tells, it doesn't tell them in a funny way. If you don't know what I mean. Like, there's a way that you can deliver a joke that can make it funnier than just the straight-up content of it. Like, if you see a joke written down, and then you can be like, okay, you know, that's a good pun, or, you know, that's a good, you know, subversion of expectation or something like that, and that's kind of funny. But even if it's a super lame joke, a talented comedian can tell it in a way to make it funny, either by using the right voice, the right delivery, or if you put it in a manga, by using the right pacing of the delivery, and by using the right art. This series doesn't really do that a whole lot. Like, for example, there is one chapter where Hina has, you know, Hina by this point has started going to school. Just because she just kind of decides to. She doesn't really go for any reason. She just kind of, like, decides to. And she started going, and she gets this idea in her head that the people who are on the student council get to make all the rules. And so she's like, I'm going to be on the student council so that I'll be allowed to sleep in class all day and get the food that I want. And it's like, okay, that's kind of funny. You know, she wants to get this position for all the wrong reasons. But she's terrible at it because Hina is this very dull girl who is stupid and has no idea how to interact with people. She has a very poor way with words. She is not charismatic in the slightest. And she has to deliver a speech. And her speech starts off as, I want to be able to sleep in class and get awesome and get really good food. And so Yuta takes pity on her and has, like, this corrupt speechwriter from a politician that they, like, control through the Yakuza to write the speech for her. And it's this great long speech that has all these, you know, examples of what to say. It has all the right proper beats, and Hina gets it, and she delivers it deadpan. And she sees instructions for her to take a breath and raise her arms, and she just goes, take a breath here.
Yeah, she reads all the cues.
And it's like, that's not funny. Because that joke is literally at least 50 years old. And it's not done in a funny way. It's just literally like people in the crowd are like, this is actually a good speech, but she's saying all the directions. It's like, I know that's the joke. Now tell it in a funny way.
See, I'm going to be the odd one out here. I actually liked that chapter a lot. I don't know why. I thought it was
funny, too. I think some of the problem with some of the jokes, especially at the beginning, I'm not saying that, yeah, of course they're funny. You just don't understand so much.
Hold on a second here.
She's like, look, what I'm saying is, Nick, you're an unfunny asshole.
Is that the translation for the first big chunk is really bad. It's really, sorry to the translators, it's really bad. Like,
I think that a lot of the humor in the series is
really, guys, so it's just as bad scanlation in the beginning, so I'm willing to hope at least that that's some of the problem, and then a lot of the jokes don't translate well.
I do agree with the problem with translation, because there are types of comedy and sensitive humor in Japanese culture that don't translate very well.
What I'm really saying is, how could you not find that funny? Oh, God.
Because it's 50 years, it's a 50-year-old joke. You can't just do that joke. You have to tell them. Okay, I'll give you another example. There's a scene where one of the very few people that befriends Hina in the series is her classmate, whose name is actually skipping me right now, because her name is also an H name.
Don't tell me into this, buddy.
Hayama? Hayami?
No.
I feel like it's something like that.
It's not that.
It's Hitomi.
Hitomi.
That's close, kind of.
No, it wasn't. All right. Hitomi is one of my favorite characters in this series. Because she's, you know, the shit upon straight man in all these, you know, ridiculous, you know, scenarios that she winds up in. She ends up working at a bar. She's essentially drafted into it, you know, and she just kind of goes along with it because she's got very little backbone and is too easygoing. But she ends up becoming this incredibly good bartender. So there's a scene where, like, a teacher of hers comes in and is kind of half drunk, and so she's like, oh no, I'm going to get found out. And so she tries to distort her face in order to, she's, you know, more difficult to recognize. But it's not a particularly, like, funny looking face that she makes. She's kind of going, whereas, like, if that scene were, like, in Nisekoi, like, can you imagine that? Like, you know, Kamiyoshi would use one of his really weird, goofy faces where he could, or something, you know, makes this ridiculous cartoonish expression. But then, a couple of pages later, there's a sequence where the teacher is suspicious and thinks it's Hitomi, but isn't entirely convinced yet, so he's like, all right, make me a drink and we'll see your skills, because, you know, no middle school student could possibly make these drinks well. And it's like a scene from Bartender, where she has, you know, with complete confidence, she's, you know, doing all these cool-looking moves and preparing the drink, and she's presenting the drinks with pure confidence in her eyes, and everyone at the bar is like, yeah, that's our Hitomi-chan, you shouldn't have challenged her skills. I thought that was hilarious, because it was done so straight, where it's just like, she's just serving a drink, and it's built up like the coolest goddamn thing. It's like, ah, yes, the deception has succeeded, because she presented him with a martini that was properly stirred.
I can see what you mean. I think there are some jokes that maybe could be better with better delivery or better art or things like that. But I still found the series funny in and of itself. Like, there's a chapter at one point later on where Anzu wants to get a video game. She wants, like, she sees Hina playing them, so she wants to get one. So she needs money, and she learns, like, oh, there's a guy who will buy TVs for you. So she, like, goes on this big trip to get them, and it's like, oh, no, I only buy flat-screen TVs. So she's like, well, crap, I need to find a flat-screen TV out there somewhere. So Hina is just, like, a one-track mind person who's just trying to help because she's bored. She doesn't even really want to help. She just has nothing else to do. So she goes out, runs into Nita, and she's like, I need a TV. And he's like, I'll just give you money for a TV. So he gives her, like, $400, essentially, or whatever. He's like, go buy a TV. Whatever, buy. So she walks out to the fucking, like, the Best Buy, buys a brand new television, drives it over to the guy who's just taking in used televisions, and gives her
that for the taxi, which costs like $100 more.
Yeah, and just gives it to him, and he's just like, there's got to be some trick to this. Why are you giving me this brand new TV? Like, and it's just like that absurdity, like, it plays upon this character of Hina that is so simple-minded, knows nothing of the world if it's not directly sort of explained to her. She only grasps the concepts of what she sees from people around her or what she picks up from pop culture. So you're able to laugh at it from that. Every character has sort of, like, their things that make them funny. Like, Nita is an asshole, and he's violent at times, and he gets drunk too often, and he has all the foibles you'd expect, but he's also slowly becoming essentially, like, a housemaid and, like, a, like, begrudging father to this little girl. And, you know, Hina is just very simple-minded. Anzu's, like, this very simple character.
Okay, there's nothing that's funny about Anzu. I'm sorry. That character makes me cry.
Yeah, she's a little... She's such a good kid.
Like, literally, like, there are moments in the series where it's like, I feel like I'm supposed to laugh, and you're like, but she's a homeless little girl!
Look how hard she's trying!
Like that whole thing where there's, like, they're trying to find the TV. You know, the punch, the bait, you said, like, the punchline is, you know, like, the guy who is, you know, buying these TVs is just like, what the fuck? These are clearly new TVs. What the hell is going on here? But then it's just like, but Anju's still homeless at the end of it.
Well, that's the thing. She's made peace with the fact that she's homeless. Like, not even made peace with the fact she's homeless. She enjoys the lifestyle. Like, I essentially, at that point, if someone had offered it to her, I don't know if she'd even take it going in somewhere else, because she enjoys living on her own and living in this community. So,
She had gotten too connected to the other homeless men there.
From her family.
So I enjoy it. It's, you know, the episode still ends with, like, a funny remark. Like, she makes a little money. It's not enough for a video game, but, you know, the entire time she'd been playing a string game earlier, and it's ultimately the string game that she's playing that she's able to do with friends. Like, it has a sweet ending to it and something that you're able to be like, oh, okay, like,
you know,
yeah, this
on,
is nice.
Oh, because, like, she's playing that together with Itomi, and Hina's with her video game, and it's like, yeah, that's right, Hina. No one loves you. Because you're a terrible person, Hina.
One other thing I really enjoy about this series is normally these sorts of series will never show violence on against children. There are several times you'll see people just fly out of nowhere and dropkick the ever-living shit out of Hina. And those are always my favorite.
She deserves it.
Sometimes it's not even necessarily she deserves it. It just comes out of fucking nowhere and just bam, she's like across the room because someone just couldn't stop or they won a video game or something like that. And every time makes me laugh.
Yeah, one time, like, Nita's sister comes along. Nita's sister, who is, like, was too violent to even be in the Yakuza. That's how crazy she is. And after she's done visiting, like, a couple of for a couple of chapters after that, Hina's wearing a neck brace because of what she's been through while she was there.
Those are, like, legitimately funny moments throughout it. It definitely has those moments that can just make you laugh in a series. I don't think it's pound for pound, like, a hilarious series, and I consider it a little bit of kind of like a mixture of drama and comedy. It's less of a drama, ultimately, because it's there to make jokes more often than not, but I think the way it's written, generally, is very strong dramatically, and it helps fill in the gaps, so you don't notice that, or at least I didn't notice that many jokes kind of missed their mark, and you only kind of remember the ones that really hit their mark and made you laugh, and you're like, oh, this is great, and I got some cool character development. Great chapter.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, literally, I think that the best parts of this series have to do with Anzu. You know, the chapters that focus on her plight and her having to get used to being homeless, like, really got me, because, you know, going through this series about this weird, awful psychic girl who I think is a terrible person, and then suddenly this other psychic girl shows up, and they have the whole confrontation, and, you know, her threat is dismissed, and Nita doesn't take her in, or rather, like, he offers to, but she is, like, too proud, I think, to accept, I believe is what happens, and so she's left on her own, and it's just, like, for, like, two full chapters of her learning what it means to be homeless. And it's like, okay, it says comedy under the list of genres for this series. No comedy I have ever had to deals with the very real problems faced by homeless populations and how hard it is to get by and what they have to go through just to live day to day. The fact that they feed off of the remnants, like, other people's trash, and all that stuff. And then, that little storyline ends with them being kicked out of their homes, essentially. Their homeless tents. It ends fine for Anzu, because she finally gets adopted by this family. And even that is not entirely happy, because she goes through this very heart-wrenching separation, because she's had to leave all these people, these guys who have basically become her new family, behind after they taught her so much. She has this big breakdown over, like, I had to leave them behind, and I'm here, and I'm alone now, and they're not with me. And she has to be told by, like, her new dad, it's like, well, yeah, they taught you all these things, but that means that they live on inside your heart. And I'm just like, oh my god, why are you doing this to me?
And that whole, the whole time when she's with the new family, like, she's,
it's
like,
so awkward and sad.
Like, oh, why are you taking a shower in cold water? Oh, because I take showers in the fountain. Oh, Anzu!
Here's the thing.
I eat hot food!
Why are you cleaning off those chopsticks? We're just gonna throw them away. Oh, but my friend told me that you could clean them off and use them like this. And literally, like, there are these little bits where her parents just kind of, like, have to walk away and go in the corner to cry for a little bit because she's saying such sad things. And it's like, that's not funny, though! That's actually sad!
I think you guys are misunderstanding something. People going through the homeless plight are inherently hilarious. Like, if you've not seen The Pursuit of Happiness, there were so many great rimshot moments in that series. Like, it's just him, like, son, I don't know if we're going to eat tonight. And then somewhere off screen, it's like, ba-dum, shh.
Oh, God.
That's how it works.
So, I mean, I really like a couple of the characters in the series. I really like Gonzu. I really like Itomi. I think Nita's a jerk, but he's a jerk I can at least laugh at. And I think that Heat is just a terrible person. Like, you selfish little brat! Fucking hell, grow up! Like, literally, there's an entire chapter dedicated to Nita's ongoing effort to try and make her a responsible member of society, and how that's a mistake. Literally. Like, he tries to get her to take, you know, like, violin lessons and cultural classes and flower ranger classes, trying at least make her a cultured jerk. And she goes crazy, basically. And her powers get out of control. And she's basically guilt-tripping him because she turns into a zombie for a long time. And it's like, but he's right, though. She is a lazy, no, good-for-nothing piece of shit. She should do something. She should at least take school seriously, because she's just sleeping through class the whole time. Ah, oh, hate her so much.
Yeah, it's especially frustrating when you see her juxtaposed with, like, Kitomi, who is working at one point, what, like, 8 different jobs?
Because she just gets roped into them.
Yeah, she can't say
and
no.
And she gets so good at them that she basically takes over the bar she's working at.
Oh, God. The scene later on when she talks about leaving the bar, and there's, like, a picture of all the bar patrons and her in the front, and the bar owners in the back just sobbing because, man, that's all her profits are gone now. Kitomi made all the money. Kitomi is by far my favorite character. All her chapters make me laugh so hard. Like the one where she tries to go to New York, and she ends up in Florida at the training camp.
Oh, God.
And I was happy to see that chapter paid off later as well.
Well, there's a couple of people that seem to have very poor senses of the direction in the series. Like the what's that girl's name? Is it Mao?
Yeah, Mao.
I think 3rd psychic girl who ends up like on a desert island because she has no sense of direction. And then when she finally gets off the desert island and tries to head to Japan, she ends up in Taiwan instead. Stuff like that just happens.
Everyone's a little bit of like a Zoro in this series.
Oh, and what the fuck is up with the Rock-Jin guys?
Oh, the like angel band?
Right. Yeah, the band.
It's like,
but that's like another... That's like another
chapter's dedicated to this not a joke.
That's what I mean, though. Like, there's just a lot of drama to the series, because that's, like...
It's dramatic, though!
It's kind of sweet that Hina has, like, has formed some kind of bond with somebody else.
I guess. Basically, to give...
You know what? Boom! I remember another Hina joke that I actually like, because there's one chapter where, and this is not going to be funny, but it's Nita at his family's house, and he's... You know, in front of his dad's memorial. I'm sure they have a specific name for it, but I can't remember.
Right, right, right.
And basically, he gets really drunk, and he's trying to perpetuate this lie that he's like, oh, I'm just taking care of this girl because she's the daughter of one of my older co-workers, essentially, who died in battle. And, you know, the lie falls apart, and at the end of it, he's like, she's my daughter. I'm not going to lie. She's my daughter. And she, you know, he shows her off to the father's memorial. And he's like, look at this, dad. You know, she's your blood. Take care of her. So a couple chapters later, she's at school and they're like, it's Parents' Day. And she gets excited because she's like, oh, your parents are supposed to come. So she tells this to Nita and he's like, I'm not your fucking dad. And she just, like, psychically punches him and, like, rips his throat all the way around. And then runs into her room because she's pissed off. And he's like, look, I apologize. I'll go to your school. And she's, like, hunkered under her covers. And he's like, come on, dinner's ready. She's like, you haven't even started cooking dinner. And I don't know why, like, I just laugh because I'm like, that's the, like, end, like, the punchline to that scene. And she's like, she's still being bitter and shitty over the fact that he's like, come on, let's go get dinner. She's like, you haven't even started yet. Fuck you. Like, they've had their emotional moment of like, you are my kid, I'll go to your school. But it's her still being like, get your ass out there and start cooking before you tell me to come out.
Oh, God. The stuff with the... There are so many times where it's just, like... There are some parts of the series that I think that worked out really well. But then there would just be... Because it's a very episodic series. Very rarely will any particular storyline go beyond two chapters. And so there would be... And it was like it's like a monthly series. So the chapters are long. So there would be times where, like, this entire chapter is dedicated to this one setup. And at the end, I'm just like... This isn't funny. This isn't interesting. The one time where Nita tries to throw out Hina until he's guilted into taking her back in, she ends up joining up with this street band. And she uses her psychic powers to, like, you know, do tricks, and she, like, levitates the singer into the air and stuff, and everyone's like, oh my god, this is amazing, you know, and so the street band makes a lot of money. But then she goes back home, and so they part ways. The next chapter that they show up again is literally just like, Hina goes to see the show, and the band is still doing rock and roll illusion. But they have to use wires and shit, because Hina's not there to psychically lift them or anything. And everyone's like, I wish they would go back to the days when they actually did do those amazing illusions and stuff. You know, it's so obvious that it's fake this time. It, you know, it doesn't look nearly as good back then. And somehow they're successful still. And so Hina goes to the show, and for one night only, she levitates the guy again. And that's it. That's the chapter. I'm like, okay.
But her bond, Nick! Her bond with them! They all put their hands in together!
Let's draw a smiley face on our hands, guys!
Be happy. She did something good.
How much would you have guys shit your pants if you were looking at my screen and you saw a third hand come in from over there?
Well, I've probably done a double take, yes. Oh, God.
I personally like Nita a lot. I think he's a really interesting character. But my favorite thing about him is how he grows with his relationship to Hina, whereas, yeah, he tries to throw her out several times, and he kind of begrudgingly starts to accept her, and after the time skip, it's not like they're magically, you know, super family, but there's that whole chapter where he's making her bento, and he's just so excited about it, and he keeps posting on his blog, single father, like, whatever.
Hashtag. Like,
and he's just like, oh, I'm so happy, and she said she really liked it. And I was like, oh, Nita's turning into such a, you know, happy dad. And then it kind of all fails, but... But I think he's really interesting, and I really like seeing how he's kind of accepted her, I guess? Maybe accepted her more and more as kind of, yeah, this is my kid.
Well, I mean, if you spend 3 years with somebody,
eventually you just have to accept, like, all right, let me just get the tax write-off at least.
Wait, does he pay taxes? I mean, he is Yakuza, so...
That's a good point. Why would he care? Oh, no, he is also... Actually, I don't know, because he seems to have very poor spending habits anyway, considering his obsession with pottery. This fucking nerd.
Pottery, drinking, and then just handing large amounts of money over to Hina whenever she
sure,
asks
go
for
get
it.
A TV, why not?
Yeah, what do you need to do? You need to buy a restaurant? Alright, here you go. Out of my hair for a couple hours.
I did think it was very sweet. Because what happens is Hina gets it in her head that Nita actually is going to throw her out if she doesn't, you know, make herself useful. So she tries to clean the house one time. And she's like, you know, got it in her head. It's like, you know, I'm going to have the house all clean, and then Nita's going to be so proud of me, and we're going to be happy together. Unfortunately, she has no idea how to clean. And for another thing, she ends up finding these salmon eggs. Salmon eggs are her favorite thing, her favorite food. And Nita had, like, put some away so that he could, like, if she, you know, behaved really well, then he could reward her. And he went so long without rewarding her, because she's a piece of shit, that the salmon eggs have gone bad. So she eats rotten eggs and gets sick. And so, because she has super psychic powers, she can't control them, and she makes a complete mess of the apartment. And she ends up wrecking this really expensive vase that he's got in his room. And so that's when he's just like, no, get out. Because by that point, he was already on the breaking point anyway. And so, to try and apologize, she ends up buying this really cheap piece of pottery from a store. Because, of course, in her head, she has no idea what the value of... She has no idea what the value of money is, and that's a running joke that she does know how things, some things are expensive. Like, she thinks that salmon eggs are like this luxurious food item, when in reality, the price goes up and down a lot. Which gets this piece of pottery that's like, you know, cheap and plastic or something like that. And so when Nita runs back into her, you know, she's like, oh, here's an apology gift. He's like, you got this for like $10, didn't you? But at the end of the chapter, he's put it on display right where the really expensive one was, because it came from Hina, and so it means a lot to him. He's like, oh, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, there is a lot of stuff in this series, individual elements that I do really like, but I did have a really hard time getting through some chapters, because they would just be built around jokes that I just didn't think were funny. Like, the one chapter where some of the students at Hina's school think that Hitomi has gotten involved in underage prostitution. It's like, this isn't funny.
Yeah, that was some
weird chapter. That's not funny if they think that. Like, and it's not done in a funny way. You know, it's not like they're like, whoa! You know, they're not overreacting to anything. It's like, they see her going into a bar, and they see a teacher going into the bar after her, and so they think, oh my god, where is she involved in? That's a legit concern to have. That's not funny. And they eventually find her out, and then some of the stuff that they talk about is kind of funny, as is the fact that the teacher still doesn't fucking recognize who Hitomi is. Because he's an idiot. But I think that this manga has a really weird idea of what is actually funny, considering the jokes about homelessness and about child prostitution and other stuff.
I think it is a fine series that lacks punch, but is still worth the read if you're looking for something to be entertained by. If you're looking for something funny, I think you can do okay with this. You might want to go with, if you're looking just to laugh and not to feel, you're not going to want to read this one. But if you're looking for something enjoyable, I think it works.
Yeah.
I've gotten more laughs out of this than I've gotten out of all of Kimmy Schmidt season 2, so it's got that going for it.
You know, the chat, Nick has a very refined sense of humor. Dick poo poo.
Yeah, I like this series. I was thinking today, like, I laugh a lot. I feel sad a lot with the series, but when it's funny, I find it just absolutely hilarious. Like, I laugh till I cry sometimes on this series, but...
And then Anji comes along and you just cry.
Yeah, and I just kind of... Those tears of laughter turn into tears of sadness. But, yeah, I don't know... It's not a series I'd go running out being like, everybody's got to read this, it's so good. I think it is a very good series. I think it's a really solid series, and I think it balances the comedy and the drama well, but I don't know. I mean, I really like it, but I guess maybe I just don't know any people in my life that would really like it like I do. I don't know.
It seems sad. You were like, I don't know anybody in my life with similar taste to me.
Well, I could just shove it on my husband, but he has a huge backlog.
We could also both pretend to have never heard of the series before, and you could recommend
guys,
it to us right now.
Suggestion. Do you like crying?
Do I? I watched Inside Out 4 times last week. Only the ping pong scenes. I love it.
Ping pong, ping pong.
That's the song I start my runs to. Him slowly singing it as he fades from existence.
And then after I collapse on all fours and just kind of lie down there for a little while, that counts as my rest before I get back up and start going again.
Then while I'm waiting for an ambulance or someone to just take me up and take me back home, I just watch the first 10 minutes of Up over and over on repeat. I basically just condense all of the saddest Pixar moments together.
Well, like that one scene at the end of WALL-E where they think that he's dead, and it looks like he's just turned into a regular robot before the kiss brings him back. I cut off right before he returns to normal.
I like to watch Monsters, Inc. right when he says goodbye to Boo, and then believe that they never meet again. Just place that in my mind that Sully never returns.
Watch that one music video with Jesse getting abandoned by her original owner.
I like that, actually. Fuck Jesse. She's the Hina of that series.
Oh, boy. Alright, so...
I'm just saying, Lotso could have trimmed some of the fat from that team, and I'd have been okay with it.
On that note... Okay, let's move on to the recap portion of Weepy Manga Recap. Let's start off with Black Clover. Page 58, the water girl grows up, a.k.a. a moment that was not earned. Okay, so...
I don't like that,
time.
Nick. You sound like you're coming in negative. We have Annalisa here, so she's going to sash you back.
Let me see here. The poll for favorite chapter of the week. One vote for Black Clover.
Shut up! I would have voted for it if Osamu wasn't in the World Trigger chapter.
Alright, so last time, Noelle was training on the shore, getting ready for everyone to head to the Water Temple, relying on her to safely get them there. Asta came across her, and then they heard singing from some mysterious siren. So, the girl notices that she's being watched by Asta and Noelle, and she immediately goes, "Oh, this is so embarrassing! Ah!" And, she is... She's very, very...
I'll admit, Nick, it's an archetype I don't care for, only because when I know these people in real life, they get on my very thin nerves quickly, but I think that's because I'm a very bitter old man at this point. I'm like, damn you, youth!
She's very... everywhere, and so happy, and so energetic. Hey, guys, let's be friends! Come on, yeah! She's that. And she, you know, introduces herself, and Noah's like, "Oh, hi, we're Noelle and Dorsta." And she's like, "Noelle and, oh, Dorsta, that's an odd name." And S is like, "That's obviously a nickname!" And he's so upset. I get it. Alright, yes.
I find it funny that she actually believes his name's Dorsta. I think what we're just discovering is you don't like to laugh.
Well, in this scene. Right?
Oh, in this panel, just did not. Holy shit! That is like a perfect like, imitation of you.
It's like completely unimpressed by everything else is going.
Like if you just slowly animated a fucking brown sugar Pop-Tart coming up towards her mouth. And pushed her hairline back a little bit, it's you down to a T.
Throw that facial hair in there, Noelle. That'll let you control that water magic of yours.
A little mustache.
And cut up the ponytails.
Put some pants on.
Seriously, though, put some pants on anyway, if you don't do any of that. So, Noelle catches on to the fact that the girl was casting magic while she was singing. And she was like, yeah, I was doing special voice training because my dream is to become a singing, dancing, magic-using idol! And Asta and Noelle are like, what the fuck is an idol? What is that weeaboo bullshit you're talking about? And she explains, oh, well, in the common realm and part of the noble realm, they're super popular. Well, then why does neither Asta nor Noelle know about them?
Because Asta's a fucking bumfuck nothing, and
but
Noelle's
a commoner.
But
Noelle is part of the noble realm.
So, well, he wasn't. I think he's lower than a commoner. He's like a peasant. Like, because the
peasant. Okay.
Yeah, because the commoner realm's like the space in between the two. He's on the far end, and Noelle's been ousted from the noble community and lives with just the black boys.
Part of the noble realm. So maybe it just didn't reach Noelle's castle or wherever the hell she lives. Anyhow, so the girl says, yes, it's my dream to be an idol so I can get super rich. I appreciate her honesty. This was honestly probably my favorite moment in the chapter where she's just like, yeah, I'm going to get super rich. And they're like, oh, so she just wants to get, okay, fine. She demonstrates her healing magic by singing. And Noelle's like, oh my god, yeah, her magic is so precise. That's amazing. And they are friends now, basically. Literally, like, they say, she's like, how old are you guys? And like, I'm 15. Oh, I'm 15 too. Let's be friends. And
Has this ever happened with anyone here? Have you ever formed a friendship with someone based solely on the fact that you're the same age or close to the same age with someone?
Sometimes you do feel a sense of kinship with someone, like, if everyone else in a large group of people is, like, a lot older or a lot longer.
Yeah.
Younger, you kind of latch onto the person who is close in age, because you can relate more to them.
Yeah.
So, I can understand that. Meeting someone completely out of the blue and be like, oh, you're 15 too? Let's be friends! Is a little weird, I admit. I do like Noelle's reaction, where she's like, I've never had a girl with my age be my friend. So she's like, yeah, okay.
I like how she's so soon there. Like, even in this moment.
She's the tsundere. That's it. That's all she is.
But I assume, like, I guess I don't read many harems or watch them or things like that, so I guess I don't get a huge deluge of them coming into me. So I always just assume they were always kind of that way, more towards just their love interest. But I like how even in this, like, friendship being brought to her, she's like, I guess if you're gonna, you know, insist you could be my friend, I guess.
Well, like, okay, Chris, you know Nisekoi.
Yeah.
Shitoge and, to a lesser extent, Tsugumi have tsundere elements, where they treat the guy that they have a crush on, you know, really harshly in order to hide their feelings. But they get along pretty normally with literally everyone else.
Yeah.
Shitoge, you know, was really looking forward to making friends. She worked really hard in order to make friends, and she was very nervous about it. And then when it happened, she didn't go, I guess we could be friends. She was super happy about it. So it is kind of weird that Noelle is just that way to fucking everyone. It has more to do with her, I am, you know, a noble, and I'm expected to act this way than anything else.
I want it to just be her way she reacts to everybody.
Like,
her fucking brother could come up and be like, we're going to accept you back out into the Noelle family. She's like, I guess I'll come in if you guys are going to be so pushy about it.
The girl says that, has she even said her name by this point?
I don't think so.
No, she hasn't. She basically said that she had seen Noelle practicing her magic, and she says, I think that you are focusing really hard on restraining your mana. You're focused so much that, you know, you're getting really tensed up, and that's why you don't have, like, a concentration. And
Sorry, she did. Her name is Kahono.
Oh, yeah, I'm Kahono. Who are you?
Kahono. There, yes.
Sorry.
So Kahono says this, which is, I think real concentration comes when your heart is relaxed. And immediately Asta follows it up with, yeah, my best swings happen when I'm not thinking anything at all! Not exactly what she was talking about. So Kahono says, oh, you should, you know, pull on your gentlest, most reassuring memory. You know, like, maybe something having to do with your family. Noelle just remembers all of her siblings shitting on her, saying that she's got no talent, blaming her for their mother's death. It's like, Jesus Christ! Talk about the wrong mission. Oh, God.
So, she's like, maybe that's not working. Maybe just think of a memory you have with your mother. Like, oh, you fuck.
Fuck off, Kono. So we get a montage of Noel trying to master Sea Dragon's Lair. And, you know, every time that she's knocked down, Asta, you know, make sure that her magic's get out of control. Kono uses recovery magic to, you know, get her back on her feet. And eventually they reach the last night before they have to get down to the Water Temple. And Kono and Asta are still there, and they're like, come on, you gotta do this. And Asta says, you know, you should just do it. You know, Kono's been saying, forget thinking sorry about stuff, just release your magic. And I was like, well, yeah, but if it doesn't go well, then I'm going to kill you guys. And Asta's like, I have magic negating sword! I told you this before Kono showed up!
He has two!
I'm probably gonna spit out a third sword and use it between my teeth, Zoro style, and that'll be like magic absorption powers or some shit. I don't know.
That's what the second sword is.
I was trying to
absorption.
One deflects, one absorbs, and then sends back. I guess that's really all you can really do. I don't know. Magic freezing.
Yeah, magic, there you go.
I guess. You touch it and it just stays there. It doesn't do anything else. Okay. So Noelle decides to unleash all of her magic. Giant surge of waves come in and she's immediately like, I knew it. You know, I can't control this. And how am I supposed to, you know, use a relaxing memory in this situation? And besides, I don't have any happy memories that I can draw on. And she starts to give up.
I've been there, girl! I know what you're going through, Noelle!
She starts to give up. And all the members of the Black Bulls all show up.
Okay, now I don't know her. Now I don't feel like I can relate to her at all. None of my friends have ever showed up in my darkest times.
And they're all, you know, staying in character, you know, while they shout bits of encouragement and advice. Like, Lux says, learn how to use that so you can fight me. Charmy says, if you feel hungry, then eat this, which I think is actually completely out of character for her.
Because she would eat it first.
Yes, exactly.
Well, no, she's always offering food to other people.
We say always, but she hasn't shown up too many times. Finral is like, if you fall, I shall catch you. And Gaush just like, you're a piece of shit. You better fucking
catch me. I love Gaush, because all of them are so supportive. And he's just supportive too, but it's just the douchiest supportive. It's like, no, if you fall, I'll kick you back up. So make it work.
So I was like, you can do it! And Noah's like, I do have kind memories inside me. I remember the whole series to this point when I tagged along on those adventures and people were nice to me. Yes. I know. Yes. Okay. And so, and of course she thinks of Asta and her giant girl boner for him, and she's like, and they all acknowledged me, gave me a mission, and I want to help them. And she masters the magic, and it turns from Sea Dragon's Lair into Sea Dragon's Cradle, which I do think is a really cool-looking thing. It's this very Last Airbender-style just globe of water around her, spinning in a perfect sphere, and little goblets of water forming a ring around it. I think it looks cool. And she's like, I did it! And then she loses concentration, so she starts to fall. And Asta catches her in his arms. Very, I guess, ideal positioning. The fact that he managed to get there before the fucking teleporter was able to reach her.
Which is a great scene, because not only I personally think it's a badass panel. He looks really cool and he's just so happy. And Finral's in the background looking like an idiot.
I love it. And Noelle's not wearing underwear.
Maybe it's a thong.
Yes, so much better.
It's like moments like this, I'm like, what is in this character's mind when she's like, I'll walk out in this mini skirt thing, this dish towel I hang over myself.
Maybe in the Clover Kingdom they just don't wear underwear. It's commando all the time.
There was a
weird place.
A D&D game I played in a while back, and my DM had created a culture where they were all idiots, and they only owned one pair of pants, and whoever owned the pants was, like, the genius, so the rest of everyone else, like, the shorter your pants were, it was, like, almost a sign of honor, so, like, everyone else had no pants. They were completely against it. Maybe that's, like, a Noel society a little bit, that, like, you have to earn your way up in rank to get pants. Until then, you wear nothing. It's where you are, you fucking plebe.
Then it'll be a thong, and then regular panties, and then spats, and then short shorts, and then... So, after Noel has her Cinderella moment with Asta's, like, why are you touching it like this? I don't want it. She then calls out to Kahono, but Kahono has disappeared. And Kahono says to herself, oh, you've got some really good friends. Well, okay, I'll be waiting for you inside the temple. And she disappears. Okay. I really hated this chapter. Really did not like this chapter. Because it's such a fairy tale chapter. Like, it's this moment.
You take that back, sir. You take that back.
Not taking it back. You know, friendship saves the day. That's all you need, is to believe in your friends and everything is okay.
After good memories.
This thing was sitting in the background this whole time. And it's just like, it feels way too sudden. You know, it feels like her development should have been more gradual over the time she was forming these memories, as opposed to, oh yeah, I do have friends, even though I kind of learned that already. It feels like it's here just to drive a point home that did not need to be driven home. Like, it's something that's like, I knew this already. I didn't need you to spell it out for me. And sometimes if you do spell things out that don't need spelling out and do it very, you know, unnecessarily sharply, even if you do that, sometimes it can be done well. I did not think it was done well here.
I think this is one of Black Clover's weaker chapters. I mean, I'm a big Black Clover fan, so I enjoyed it mostly. I had to work on this one while I was kind of on vacation, so.
Aww.
Oh.
But, I liked it. They drop little things that I find are interesting, like, you find out a little bit about Noelle's mom.
Oh, yeah.
And
that's harsh stuff right there.
Which is, yeah, really harsh, and, like, okay, so she was this great person, and, yeah, all her family hates her, you know, but, like, oh, and the reason she's dead is because of Noelle, kinda, you know? And so they drop little things that I like, some parts I felt on this chapter went a little slow and some parts went too fast. But I don't know. I mean, overall, I really like it. I love Gaush's, you know, hateful support. I love anytime Gray shows up, I find it hilarious. So.
Because there's just like two of one character.
Yeah, because there's two of one character. And then the whole Asta catching Noel, I love that panel. If you want minor, really stupid, not really spoiler, one of these flashback panels is actually from the first volume of the manga, so it's all properly lettered with all the sound effects. It's my, I was too lazy to find
the one. One
of the background ones, so it has all the sound effects in it. Oh, okay. So least to find the other one. That's your Easter egg.
Our inside dope.
Dope. Yeah. It's a. Yeah.
I'm a disagree with both of you. I thought this was a great chapter. Was that you? Like a cat.
Sorry. I was just like way too perfectly timed for you to pass up the chance.
I enjoyed this chapter a lot. I can see what you mean in that it feels very fairy tale-ish, but I think. The reason I enjoy it is because the reason fairy tale chapters bother me so much is because they do them all the fucking time that they lose all meaning. This is kind of one of the very few instances I think of Black Clover doing a chapter with this kind of conclusion in particular. And I always have thought Noelle was the series' most interesting character. She's honestly who I'd choose to be a protagonist if I could, because she has a real underdog.
You're Cinderay girls. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Excuse me, Chris. If you look in the introductory page, who is featured in the panel above Noelle's? Well, that does not appear in this chapter.
That's because Yino always appears in that. He'll die in the series at some point and still show up in that sidebar. But I enjoy it. I like, you know, the fact that it's, you know, her, all her entire friends and the guild shows up and she's reminded of that. Like, it's cheesy, but it's that shonen kind of attitude that I feel like does work for the series. If anything, the only thing in the chapter I didn't care for was just Kahano, and that's only because she kind of felt unnecessary. Like, I like the tease at the end where she's like, I'll see you in the temple, and you're almost like, oh, is this kind of like a test on her behalf? You know, is she not necessarily as friendly as she seems? But ultimately, she didn't really do anything. She's like, hey, remember your family? And I was like, all my family memories are sad. And she doesn't say anything else. She's just like, oh, well, let's figure something else out. But I like what they do there. And you know what? I think maybe part of the reason you're not crazy about this chapter, Nick, is a little bit of it's missing from the fact that we're reading it in a written medium. I think perhaps it would take just a little bit of channeling to get into it. So I think we should reread the scene with Kahano singing to Ash to heal his injuries with a random voice generator to pick what the singing voice is going to sound like. And, ooh, Donald Trump gets to sing, Nick! Please don't use the N-word.
So you want Donald Trump singing to heal Asta's injury?
Yeah.
La la la, feel bad already, you stupid piece of shit. Oh, you're so lazy. Oh, my arm is so bad, I can't move anymore. It's like, oh, if my arm got hurt like this, I would just raise the other arm, and then I would use it to grow another arm, and then I'd have three arms, one of which wouldn't be too good, but it would still be better than most people's arms, because that's how great my arms are. I have the best arms. Anyway, get up!
That's awesome! My muscles don't hurt anymore! Yeah! See, now I think you're going to enjoy the chapter more with that.
I don't think so. I feel like this could have been good if it had been, like, three chapters instead of one.
Yeah, I could understand that.
Like, introduce Kahano and, you know, I guess build more, make a bigger deal out of Noelle's flashback in the first chapter. Have her start resuming training at the end of it. Second chapter, have her continue to struggle. Have her bond more with Kahano. Have Kahano give her more advice and ask to still be there helping her out. And then have that one say, and then it was the last day. And then have that be climactic scene where she masters the translator, drawn out over a longer period so you can make a much more big dramatic deal about it over the course of the chapter. That is how I would have done it. I'm no mangaka, but I feel like it could have been done much better and been made a much bigger deal out of and had been more satisfying if it weren't just Noelle has no good memories. No, she does. And that's it.
I can understand it.
So that was why I made the fairy tale comparison. More than just friendship saves everything was, well, that sure happened really quickly, didn't it?
I feel it was harsher than you intended, if only because Fairy Tail was so god-awful this week that it's so much worse of an insult.
But Fairy Tail had one really awesome panel in it this week. Anyhow.
I'll have to remind myself when I get to it, because I remember steaming piles of shit until an awful conclusion.
Well, that was easy, wasn't it? Anyhow, let's move on to Bleach. Chapter 116. Or not 116. That's the page it's on. Sorry. I'm going to page 116. Seconds. Chapter 670. Well, this was weird. So, Zaraki's super strong, chopping people in half, ripping people's arms off with his teeth and stuff. Byakuya and Hitsugaya are observing that he is super awful berserk. Meanwhile, Gerard's completely bisected body goes full release. I think the Sturditer 5 segmented thing appears in his head as he's coming back together. And he grows a beard. Okay.
Like a cool, almost like steel beard. Like it's part of the helmet, it feels like.
His sword is super awesome. It's shooting lasers out of it. He's completely wrecking the entire landscape that he's on. And he's like, I am Ashtonig, the noble warrior of God.
Actually, I just realized it, Nick. See, with his big power up there, he got pants. So I think what Noelle just needs to do is get bisected in half by Kenpachi, and then she'll level up and she can have pants then.
He's swinging his sword down, and Zaraki tries to counter by swinging his cleaver, and in the motion of swinging, his arm breaks open.
Yeah.
And, this confirms that Yachiru is only visible to him as she appears on his arm, and says, I'm sorry, I released too much of your power. Your body, I guess, can't handle it. So Gremy was right the whole time.
Maybe, you know what? That almost adds a better explanation to why Gremy exploded. He's like, if he actually imagined his power, and you're like, no, even Kenpachi's body can't handle the power his body actually has, and that's why it's still awful. But at least it gives it a bit more justification. You're like, you're too scurry!
So, Zaraki's arm just kind of explodes off. Add that one to the counter. And as a result, he's not able to counter. Gerard crushes him with his sword. It's hard to actually tell exactly what's happened to his body because of the way that the path of the sword is drawn. You see his arm on one side, and then you see the rest of his body on the other, and I think that it might have actually missed him, honestly.
Oh, shit!
Because, like, you see, well, look at that. There's, you know, the path of the sword, and then there's Zaraki's body on one half of it, and then his arm, which already exploded off on the other half of it. So, did he just, like, his arm exploded off, and that just kind of part his body onto either side of Gerard's blade?
Well, it's actually kind of weird, too, because if you look in the page before it, you can see where his arm's been lost, and it's been lost kind of, like, right about here. Like, it's halfway down the bicep. If you look at the dismembered arm
That's
on that page,
arm.
It looks like it's from shoulder socket down to fingers.
Yeah.
Because his arm explodes, like, almost at the elbow. And yeah, it looks like it's exploded off of his shoulder in the aftermath picture. Mm.
Yeah, it does look like he missed. Like, somehow, he was prone, so you get a plus prone. Two, you get combat advantage, and you still missed him. You're so big!
Oh, God. Well, that's that size differential attack penalty there. So, Zaraki seems to be done, basically. Hits the guy, and Byakuya have to pick up the slack. Unfortunately, Byakuya observes that this guy looks like he's on at his limit. He's like, you need to stop your Bankai. You're at your limit. You know, I can tell the bells are almost disintegrating. This guy's like, no. And by the way, I don't recall ever saying that it's over when all the ice flowers fall. When the ice flowers have all fallen, that's finally when Daigurin Yorinmaru is complete. Sorry, his voice broke, so I had to do it for that there. He becomes super adult, open-shirted.
He's super hot. He's super Bashonen now, right?
And we get the chapter title, The Perfect Crimson, which is a play on Daigurin. Okay, so I don't recall ever saying that the Espada were ranked 1 to 10, Chris.
When did you think that you were truly in control?
When did you think that you weren't under the illusion?
It's
bullshit. The most bleach.
It's like Kubo's version of What a Twist! It's just like, when did you think ... presumed a thing of the series as a counterpoint out of nowhere?
Yeah, you know, because whenever Hitsugaya was, you know, getting all worried and trying to rush the battle to his conclusion before he got super strong.
Now, it's because he's too Bishonen. He would be mobbed by girls.
Oh, all the girls would freak out if they saw me like this. Fortunately, they're all dead or unconscious right now. Can you imagine if Hinamori saw me like this? She'd be all over me, and I want her to stay my friend/sister for years.
Yeah. Plus, I look like I'm 30 now, and she's dead. I don't want to get into that. I don't know if there's laws in Soul Society, but it's a moral one I just won't cross.
Oh, God. So stupid. Now, such a stupid fucking development. And then he gets adult when he's powered up.
Now, here's a way they can maybe justify it. Is because a big theme we've been kind of seeing here is that to beat the Vondenreich, I forgot they're called the SS, the Elite Guard. Yeah, to beat them, almost everyone seemed to have to pull out a technique that is just about lethal to themselves. Now, it hasn't actually killed anybody, but Shun Sui's Bankai was supposedly one that killed himself along with the villain. You know, Mayuri had to lose Nemu to kind of get to that. Urahara kind of had to release his body. Maybe there's something to this where if he fully releases or completes or whatever, he's stronger, but it's something he can't come back from, or there's some kind of bad turnabout from it, like some negative drawback. I could maybe see it. But the way it's presented here definitely comes across as like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm pretty sure there were fights in the past where you've been like, oh no, my flowers have almost all melted. I better finish this quickly, instead of being like, I'll just wait 5 more minutes, get super stronger.
I mean, he has been deliberately ambiguous about his powers. I think that, what was that guy's name? One of the first Arrancar that showed up, and kind of was like, Grimmjow's second in command, or whatever the fuck.
Oh, Lil Paulo.
No. You're thinking of the guy who replaced him.
Okay.
He was like Arrancar 11 or whatever.
You're not gonna go. This isn't boding well for you in that Blue Chop competition.
I haven't started training for that yet. Kangdu? Something? He had a very Asian name.
Xiaolong? People were saying Xiaolong.
It was Xiaolong, yes. That was it, yes. Yeah, so he basically theorized that what Hizukai's, you know, petals meant, and Hizukai was just kind of like, well, that's an interesting theory. That was basically like what he said, was he didn't confirm or deny it either way. But from that point on, the petals were a very big focal point of, you know, the artwork, and it was like, oh, the time limit. What is the time limit leading up to? So I will give, you know, Kubo credit for Hizukai never actually saying it at any point or another, and him being kind of coy about it, but still, it's such a Bleach thing for him to do, you know. It's like, oh, you were expecting it meant one thing, well, just because my behavior seemed to match up with that theory doesn't mean it was actually what you thought it was.
Well, I like that it's almost like a fuck you to the audience more than anything else. Like, yeah, this is the assumption all you plebeians were under, but I got you on this. I'm like, but you only gave us the information to make this assumption.
You thought, oh, who did you think the anonymous Raw General Manager was? Mick Foley? Well, I'll show you.
It felt like there was ever a point where he was like, oh shit, Baz B's kicking my ass. If only I could hold on for one more minute.
Right. Oh god. So, and on top of that, I get super bitched when this happens. It's such a stupid
development. Well, that's because he's so attractive now, Nick. Now everybody can feel shamelessly glad to ogle him as much as they want.
I do kind of like the way that his, because you see like a bit of his forearm, and I'm kind of wondering if that's like his flesh or if that's just ice. It's around his arm. I do think
so. It'd be interesting. It feels flesh.
I do think it would be cooler if like his actual body were part ice, but
Like fucking Sub-Zero from Deadly Alliance, where like his arms were just ice now for some reason.
Sure, why not?
He's fucking him.
I totally get that reference. Anyway, that's Bleach. It was stupid. Let's move on to Fairy Tail, which was totally better.
Oh god! All right, so. Fairy Tail, Chapter 482, Fighting Spirit. So last time, we had been revealed that, I can't remember this guy's name, did they say it in here? Nineheart. Yeah, Nineheart, the new Spriggan 12 member, has Historia magic. So he can bring back people's memories to fight them again, essentially. And he can do it without any sort of limit, it seems. He's got people fighting their opposites all over the battlefield. And, you know, we start with fighting against Gray and Leon, and essentially they're like, oh, I can't believe you're using her magic. You know, I know it's not you, but she's so strong. And Gray's like, let's beat her, because we don't want anybody to sully her name. And, you know, then they cut around to a bunch of other fights where the relationship between these two characters isn't nearly as compelling. Where it's like, Zonkro's like, yeah, I died on an island, and you moved on, and I hate you for that. And I'm like, I don't even remember you. I know you were part of the same group, but you didn't seem to like each other. You were such a jerk. And, like, Luvia has a line with the necromancer where she's just like, how dare you defile the dead? I'm like, what does that even mean from her? Like, it's such, like, a weird line to give her. Like, I don't know. Like, these fights outside of against Gray and Leon just kind of seem like, I guess we just had to fill this with something. Because it definitely was never like, oh, Luvia's grand antagonist, necromancer dude! But Nineheart is chuckling to himself about how DeMaria and Wall were so pitiful because these wizards are no trouble at all. And we see Urza in her three-person, you know, handicap match, and she's struggling, you know, valiantly to defend against them. But ultimately, three opponents, all of this caliber, are simply too much for her. You know, she tries to take to the air, and the vine guy shows up, kicks her back down to the ground. She gets up just in enough time for Kyoka to slash her, but it's one of those fairy tale shots where it only rips her pants, which I can't...
It's a very Nakima attack.
I can't fathom how that even works, like how the claw just catches the clothes, because nothing... Her underwear's still on, so it's not even like, oh, well, it just tore off part of down there. No, it just caught the pants.
Well, they look a little baggy, a little bit. I just dodged at the last second, guys, okay?
I guess. I'll go with that. Oh. But she's you know, half naked now at this point, and Kyoka's...
Look at that.
...happy. She's ecstatic. She's like, oh, yeah, string her up. And the wood guy uses...
Asuma.
Yeah, Asuma uses... It's more bondage
It's a very creepy scene, honestly, because literally, like, she goes... Because Kyoka goes from a pretty gruesome thing where she, like, you know, takes her clawed thumb and just digs it into her abdomen for a bit after she's multiplied her sense of pain. And she's like, oh, what if I raise your pain even more? Or would you rather I raise your pleasure? And just starts grabbing her boob right after that. Just like, ugh! Creepy!
This is all meant to be very reminiscent of the fact that this was essentially the same sort of scene that happened back in the Tartarus arc. When she was the, you know, prisoner of the demons. And she's even calling back to her, like, oh, doesn't this remind you of that? And Urza has a response, like, yes, and I think that's enough of this reunion party, because all three of you stood against me as very challenging enemies, but I defeated you! And Kyoka starts, like, saying, shut up! And she starts attacking her, and you just see these, like, just slashes happening over and over, and the sound effects, which aren't just doom, which is surprising to me. And she's taking all these attacks, and Urza's not flinching, she's not shying out of pain, she's just steely-eyed, focused, and Kyoka is baffled by this. And Urza just says, be gone from my sight, ghost, before you feel the bite of my blade again.
Now, stop. I think that this one two-faced red is fucking badass. I think this. So she's completely helpless, and you're just like, I'm going to kill you all if you don't get away from me. And she actually believes it. What happens as a result of this is really weird.
So, Asuma, Kyoka, and the other sword girl fucking vanish from existence because they can't comprehend fighting her again. They're so terrified of fighting her that they just disappear.
The Historia vanishes because the spirits that were conjured were terrified of Urza.
Yeah, they all disappear. Now,
so, rather than giving them a hug,
yes,
like Naruto, you just have to make them pee their pants.
Yeah. Well, just in this situation, it's very likely the fight with Ur ends with a hug.
Gray and Leon should go up to her, and be like, "Mom, I'm thinking about getting a tattoo across my head."
She's like, "Oh!" And I'm gonna destroy all my savings account and just start buying video games. It's just, oh no! So irresponsible. So Erza falls to the ground, presumably defeated, but it, really the only thing that comes from it is that Gerard has seen her battered and defeated and wounded on the ground, and he gets his scurry face on, and he's gonna, I guess, yeah, get, Nick's got it right there. Nailed it. He's gonna, I guess, kick Nineheart's ass in place of Erza. And that's the chapter.
You know, I love scenes where somebody's getting beat up and they're like, "No, you know, not yet. I'll take you down." I love it. Like Nick said, you know, this two-page spread, it's like, "Oh, that's really badass." But then it's just like, "Oh, just kidding. It's now it's
she
dumb."
She didn't actually do anything. She just made them run away.
Yeah, like, "Oh, you glared so hard at them." They're like, "Now I'm scared." She's still freaking tied up, you assholes. How dumb are you?
Like, and it's weird because the fact that they're conjured by Historia is the thing that makes this lame. Because imagine if, like, she did this to real people and it was just like, she is literally so intimidating that they completely lost the will to fight her, even when she's completely helpless. But it's like, no, she made the spirits scared and so they were dispelled. What? So because they actually have the memories or whatever, or personalities, the things they use to fight actually have human weaknesses too. That seems bad.
All the same one too. Like, they all are just terrified at the notion of fighting her, which is weird because they were pretty cool with it at the start. Like, they all have the memory of losing to her, I presume. But so I guess
maybe he should have conjured the memory of someone who had kicked Erza's ass and never been defeated by her.
Acnologia? He's not dead.
Like,
I don't know.
God damn it! Nobody's dead that's actually beaten someone in Fairy Tail.
You know, it could be a cool scene, but it really is ultimately, I don't even like that scene. I think it's kind of lame in this context. I like scenes you're talking about. You know, Tommy Dreamer, "Yes, sir, can I please have another?" Like, I always kind of like those scenes. They do, you know, with characters in a shitty situation, but they're gritting their teeth through it and looking cool. But here it's like another one of those scenes where Erza's just like, "I can do this because I'm Erza." And it's a moment that I feel like is going to have no consequence. Like, it's just another one of those fairy tale moments where she's like, "I can beat Kyoka and her pain amplifying ability because I'll just overcome my sense of pain." And it's like, "I know I'm in a shitty situation here, you know, basically fucking trussed up and having all of my pain, essentially having three opponents using their ultimate attacks on me at once. But fuck it, I'm Erza, I'm going to beat you, and I'm going to scare you all so they all vanish."
It is the fact that she is Erza that also takes away from the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, if this were actually someone else, I probably wouldn't care, but it's like, oh,
fucking
God.
Levy is trussed up like that, she's like, "I'm going to draw your asses to death," and be like,
"Yeah!" I'd be like, "I'm so pissed, I don't know what that means, but yeah!" But it's just like another moment, it's like, I get it, Erza's super cool, and every fight with her ends in the lamest way possible. Yeah, it's your thing. This is Heroes. Oh, you thought it worked like this?
You thought Erza might be challenged?
when did you have the idea that Erza could be challenged in a believable manner?
Oh, but
so, right. I don't know. Well, we'll see what happens. It looks like Gerard might get the fight. I imagine Erza will be up.
It's okay. It's okay, Chris. We're going to start getting some good chapters from this week now. Okay. Food Wars. Shokuyaki no Soma. 163. Those who reach for the top. Lots of color pages to open this up. Very cool looking pages.
I
like them. I actually really like the first page more than the two-page spread. The one that has the, you know, Soma when he issued his challenge at the very beginning of the series. And then, you know, he and Megumi observing Tsukasa. And then autumn leaves and Sakura petals and stuff. Because it's been a long time. See, but they've been there. Seasons change and stuff. See?
That's a little trivia fact I didn't even notice in it. I guess because I would be able to flip through the pages and be like, "Someone told me there's a naked girl in this chapter somewhere."
So, Selma, it just like, so wait, are you serious? If I win, then you're gonna let me be the first seed? And Sagat's like, well, yeah, but if you lose, okay, let's do it. But you know, that's Selma in a nutshell. He sees his chance and he doesn't care about consequences if he loses. And so Selma and Tsukasa lay out the rules of their contest, and they both get ready to go. And they still haven't noticed that Erina and Hisako are watching them. Again, how is this contest going to be judged? So, let's see here. Selma says that they should do French, and Tsukasa says, oh, you know, we've got venison here because of the what the class was originally going to go over. So, French-style venison dish is what they're going to do. And pretty much most of the rest of the chapter, after Selma is like, oh, you know, I'll put all that teaching that, you know, I got from Shinomiya to good use, it's, from then on, it's mostly just Tsukasa just cutting meat and hugging deer.
I love... See, these are, I think, maybe the best parts of Food Wars, are these scenes where we find a character and we're getting introduced to his or her style of cooking. And it's always this very grandiose, very flowery way of explaining what makes them such a great chef. And it's all told through, like, this symbolism of these, you know, exaggerated scenes of what makes them so special. And I don't know if there's going to be anything better than the one of Tsukasa slowly bringing a deer in and, like, caressing it.
I was so waiting for him to crack its neck.
Yeah, knowing full well he just murders the shit out of this deer and is cooking it. Like, I love that this deer's so happy, and as he's saying it, he's just like, now please, live on in my dish. And, like, the deer's so happy. Presumably he understands it, too. The deer's just like, oh, I can't wait to be fucking mutton chops. Oh! Like, you don't have mutton.
There is also a bit where, as he's preparing the dish, Hisako gets a whiff of it, and that makes her clothes blow off. And it's like, well, this is a bad sign for Soma, then, isn't it? Even Erin is, like, freaking out, like, chewing on her finger as she's observing all this, trembling. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, Soma, you're so going to lose. Then we get, they kind of stop cooking for a little bit and start talking again.
This is where, like, Tsukasa's like, alright, now I need to let my deer marinate in honey mustard for 10 minutes. I'm gonna have a conversation back and forth, and someone's like, yeah, I still haven't even picked my dish yet, why not?
It's kind of bad playing on his part. But someone gets, his curiosity gets the better of him, he's like, what are you trying to do with Central? You know, you guys are going on about, oh, true gourmet and stuff, but, I mean, is that really just going to involve taking control of Tatsuki and that's it? And Tsukasa says, well, no, actually, once the institute is under our control, they're probably going to actually shut down every restaurant in Japan. And so I like how Soma, instead of being like, no, he's just like, wait, what? Are you serious?
I almost want to kind of replace his face with that what woman face, like the old lady, like, what?
Tsukasa says, you know, all the restaurants that serve proper gourmet, oh, that's fine, but, you know, Dean Azami said, those restaurants that serve slop, the fodder that cannot even be called food, oh, god damn it, I'm stepping on skulls. It's not very stable footing here. Hey, they must be eliminated. That's an absolutely necessary, unavailable step in taking Japan's culinary world to even greater heights. Still a badass panel, though, looking all evil, standing on his mountain of skulls, including one that has a really fucked up mouth over on the left side. You see that one?
At him.
Well, it's like, because the jaw is dislodged, it looks like just Carl.
Or its mouth is open for the true cuisine.
Birdman!
He's hungry, because he was one of the plebeians who did not get true cuisine. Mm-hmm. He died hungry.
Tsukasa says that taking over Tatsuki is just the first step in Azami's plan. He needs an army of elite chefs that are part of his ideal. The purge of the dissidents and the regimented classes, everything that's going on Tatsuki right now, is just the beginning of preparation. Eventually, Central and its ideals will grow beyond the Institute and spread across the whole country, closing down any inferior restaurants. And so Soma is like, well, then if you're closing inferior restaurants, then that means that, you know, diners and family places like Minamura's or my home, you know, that you can hear a shop, you're saying that they don't deserve to exist. And it's just like, yeah, pretty much. So someone says, okay, so that means that even if it means, you know, people lose the place they're precious to board, then he's still going to do this. And Sagat says, yeah, it kind of sucks, but we kind of have to do it.
He's so pretty while he does it, though.
Yeah, Sagat's just, I mean, it's great. He's like, he has, like, no empathy. He just doesn't get it, you know? Soma, you know, thinks back on the good memories he's had, you know, when he was a kid hanging out at the shop, when he was, you know, working with his dad, getting to know all the locals and so on and so forth. And he says, I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure I'm not cut out to be your right-hand man, and I decide what I'm going to make. And gets his selected dish, and Aaron and Hizaka are like, oh, what kind did he get? And then he says, I'm not going to join Central. I can't. Sorry, but I'm winning this match. Yes. Really like this chapter. It's nice to actually have actually motivated Soma. Because he's such a selfish guy, you know, for a protagonist for a series like this. You know, he only took on Aizon because he was going to lose the place that was precious to him. But in this one, you can actually tell, because he is primarily motivated by the fact that, you know, his dad's shop would be closed down. But he is thinking about the other people that he's met along the way. There are other places that are important to him, and he you know, cares about other people who have places that are important to them. And that's the big reason why he wants to stand against them. So, good stuff.
I liked it. I know some people are upset because they don't like what Dina Zombie's plan is. I know people in the chat are making... people in the chat are also making, like, the comparison of, like, well, what, he's going to close down all Taco Bells and fast food restaurants?
Yes!
I think that definitely would be part of it, even though he wouldn't have the potential. But I think it's even less of those ones and anything specifically, he uses the example, like, diners, cafeterias, family restaurants. I think those are the real targets he's going after. The places with people who actually think of themselves like chefs and serve food that he's just looking all the way down from, you know, just thinks all of it's just complete and utter shit. Even I think upscale restaurants that he's like, these don't have my standards. Because look how he's even thinking about Totsuki. Like, we've seen him go after and expel and kick people out of his groups that are good chefs, that are very good chefs. Like, he clearly has a, like, absurdly high standard when it comes to it. So I don't think he's just like, oh, you cooked... He's not just going after me. Like, he's not just going to be like, what, everything needs honey mustard? You're fucking ridiculous. I think he's going to go after,
dude,
like...
Stop eating those Pop-Tarts. Eat a real breakfast.
Yeah, he's going to go after fucking Bobby Flay's restaurant and be like, not everything needs barbecue sauce on it, and slaps it out of his hand.
Goes over to Paula Deen, stop putting butter in that!
Like, he just has this absurdly high standard for everything. And I think that's more of where it comes down to. And yeah, it's an absurdly stupid plan, but it's also a manga all about an entire academy that seems to perpetually exist just off of cooking. Like, it's funny and weird, but it's also fitting for his plan, and it works as a sufficient motivation for Soma to get into this battle beyond just, hey, you should eventually stop this Azami guy, because he's kind of like monster puppeting Erida over there.
Personal mistakes are always good. Alright.
So I just want to mention it, because I'm not going to talk about it, but Hunter x Hunter did come back, and previously when Hunter x Hunter was out, I did recap the chapters of it. I will not be doing it this time. If only because fool me three times, shame on me. I wish nothing but the best to Togashi-sensei. I'm just not going to get invested into it again if it turns out, you know, within 3 months or something like that, it's back on hiatus or something like that. So, sorry, guys.
Let's do My Hero Academia, number 87, Clash, featuring very scary-looking, more realistic-style All Might on the cover.
He looks real creepy on this one.
It's a lot of it has to do with the teeth, I think.
Wait. Yeah, if I cover up the teeth, it's not as creepy.
Like, if it were just, like, the eyes, that would be really badass with the shadows and stuff, but those teeth, something about them. Mm.
Yeah, it's something about those big blue eyes that make me just gonna go swimming in them so deep I get lost. I need someone to save me.
Big, strong, number one hero?
Yeah, someone like a big,
I'll save you from my teeth.
From his eyes! Nick, you can't swim in teeth! If Hina Matsuri were at the topic for this week, that'd be the title of this episode, too.
Alright. Sudeku and company have come across the building that they believe the Bakugo is being held at. But they're, you know, don't really have any means of getting inside. And there's a couple of moments where... there's a moment where, like, some random drunkards come by and... they ask Yayorozu, like, hey, you wanna come with us, baby? And Ida, of course, responds with, Earl Gay with Igbebu Uzbe, because he's weird right now. And Deku's like, you're talking to me?
You're a big My Hero fan, Annalisa. Is this something he did before this that I've forgotten about?
I don't think so. I think he's just trying to make this part of his adopted persona for this.
Okay, so he's
that
just being weird right
because
now.
Deku's doing his weird punk, unconvincing punk act. And also, he is wearing a shitty mustache. So, they get to a more isolated area, and they make another joke about Yairozu's boobs, which I think is much funnier this time, because they're squeezing down a tight, you know, corridor. And Yairozu is like, it's so narrow, I might get stuck. And you see Kirishima in the foreground just kind of go...
his face just makes that sound.
Oh, boy. So they come across the window, and they're like, if we could reach up there, you know, we might be able to see inside. Oh, but it's so dark. And Kirishima is like, I've got a camera that's got, like, night vision installed into it. And they're like, how fucking rich is Kirishima? Because that's an expensive model that he got. Because we don't really know very much about Kirishima's background, do we, at this point?
He's one of those characters who we've seen glimpses of, but we've never really gotten... he's never been, like, a focal character so much. Like, he was obviously one meant for more importance. He was one of the top, what, 8 students in the student battle tournament.
Right, and he had that punching
man. Final 4, I guess, or Final 8. I'm trying to remember.
I think Final 8.
He was in the fight with Tetsu Tetsu.
He beat he went up against Bakugo. Bakugo beat him, and then did he go right from that to the fight with Todoroki?
I can't remember. I just remember that. How many people did Deku beat in the tournament?
Only beat Shinso.
Yeah.
He beat that dude and lost to Todoroki.
I think that it was only. I think that there were 6. There were 16.
16, and I think he made it to the second...
He made it to the second round.
Second round, yeah. Okay.
He had the fight with Tetsu Tetsu that went to a draw, and then he won an unarmed wrestling contest against him.
Yeah.
Anyhow. So, they kind of do this thing where, you know, Kirishima and Deku stand on Todoroki and Ida's shoulders in order to, you know, sneak a glimpse through there, and they're like, oh my god, holy shit, there's a facility for Nomu in there! Which is really creepy. They're just, you know, like, sitting in tanks with all these tubes hooked up and stuff.
But I love that they were smart enough to make sure there's proper safety signage over the Nomu tank. That's just like, safety first!
Or we'll turn you into another Nomu.
Like, I want to think of it like my office place. Like, we have these fucking signs that are like, Paul was sick, but Paul decided to come into work anyway. Then Paul used the copier, and so did 30 other people. Don't be like Paul. I want, like, the villain sign for that. Like, Paul was sick. Paul came into work. Paul used a copier. So did 30 other people. So we fucking killed Paul. Don't be like Paul!
Oh, God.
And it's just a picture of his, like, hanging corpse next to it as a reminder. But still, like, a smiley face next to it.
So, we cut to inside of the facility where the villains, of course, still have Bakugo kind of cornered. And Bakugo is pretty clear, because he's putting on a tough act still. You can tell he's getting kind of nervous. He's got, you know, sweat dripping out his cheek, and he's kind of shaking a little bit. And Shigaraki is like, all right, Kurigiri, compress, let's, you know, put him to sleep again, and then we'll deal with him later. And so Baku was trying to think of a plan, And all of a sudden, there's a knock at the door. Someone at the door says, "Pizza." Pizza delivery is here. And then All Might comes crashing through the wall.
It's All Might saying it, so I like to think he's even doing it in zero voice. Like, "Hello, delivery from your local Kamenawa Pizza."
He doesn't come in through the door. You can see the door intact.
Oh, he's not. Oh, I really like to think
of
him. That's
a different hero saying that.
Oh, lame. I really like the idea of him in like his hero voice being like, "Hello, delivery from your local pizza place."
The villains try to react. Shigaraki is like, "Kirigiri, you didn't warp us away." But immediately they're all snagged by this wood-warping hero. Just bound up. Dobby is like, "Oh, well, that's wood. I'll just burn this out." Gran Torino comes in, kicks him across the back of the head, knocks him out immediately.
Yeah.
Heroes just fucking wreck house, basically.
It's so badass.
They're like, "Oh, yeah, you know." And All Might says, "This is our young upstart Kamui Woods and the speediest old-timer out there, Gran Torino. There is no escape for you, League of Villains. Why, you ask? Because we are here!" Such an awesome panel with all the posing. They're trying to come up with something to do, and the guy who was at the door comes through. Very anime-looking that guy.
We found out his name like a week ago, too. I'm forgetting. Like Cutter Edge or something like that?
Something like that. He just, snaps his way in through the door. I think he cuts the... He must cut, like, the deadbolt or something like that. I guess that's what happens. Then he just opens the door. SWAT team comes in behind him. They've got Endeavor covering stuff outside, being like, "Why the fuck does All Might get to go in? I know!" All Might, says, "Oh, good job, holding out, Bakugo. I'm sorry, but it looks like you're okay now." And Bakugo's like, "I almost am! What are you talking about?"
His face in that panel, though, I'm sorry, but you're okay now. It looks like he's just like, I'm not gonna cry because I'm so happy. Here's a tsundere character.
This is the male tsundere.
Yeah.
I like it, too, because you don't get to see Bakugo vulnerable very much. He's such an angry child.
It was basically like, not really since like the first chapter have you seen him like this.
But him being saved by his hero... clearly see is affecting. It's a very nice touch.
So Shigaraki is like, "That's all right. I've still got one more ace in the hole. We're not the only ones you have to worry about. Kuragiri, bring them all over to play. Bring in the Nomu." The Kuragiri is like, "The Nomu are gone." And All Might says, "It looks like you've still got a lot to learn, Shigaraki. Your little league has gone and taken some things lightly, like this boy's indomitable spirit and the police's relentless investigation, as well as our rage." By this point, their other group of heroes have already stormed the Nomu facility and disabled them all. And it looks like they've recovered Mandalay. Because Tiger's holding her in his arms. I assume that's her, at least.
Yeah.
Also, I want to see more of snappily dressed Shark Man.
Oh, okay. No, he's an orca. He's from...
That's even better, though!
He's from, Omega Doki Dobutsu and Horikoshi's series before Barrage.
Really?
He's one of the villains, and
please
and
don't
he's
tell
so
me this is
badass.
Please don't tell me this is just a cameo.
He was in the last chapter, so I really hope he'll show up more because he's a badass. Like,
hell yeah!
He's so cool. I'm so excited, guys.
Oh my god! If the character starts showing up from his old series, we might see the space whale soon, Nick. Freaking dream.
I think from Omega Doki, like 3 or 4 characters have already shown up, but maybe once he runs out of characters from that series, we'll see the Barrage.
I mean, when you consider the fact that the 10th most popular character in Nisekoi was his last series, that was the most bizarre goddamn poll.
That was great.
Anyhow, yeah, we close on All Might saying, your mischief has gone on long enough. It ends here, Tomura Shigaraki. And Tomura's just like,
Hurrumph.
Where are the Nomu?
They're supposed to be here.
I know some people have been angry at this chapter, because they're like, the heroes won too much. First and foremost, the heroes looked awesome in this chapter, because this is the top of the top of the heroes. This is the number one, the number two, the number three. I think it's numbers 1 through 5 of the heroes in a coordinated strike force attacking a group of mostly rookies and, like, part-timer villains and breaking into their base and just being smart in them, and I think that's awesome. But the thing to remember, they're not going to win out in this. Like, I know some people worried that they're going to...
Did not show up to this just to be like, oh, the heroes saved Bakugo. Something is going to happen with them.
Yeah. There's too many things that have been shown, teased, and not happened. Remember, we haven't seen All For One show up. We haven't seen Shigaraki's power yet. We don't know what it can do yet, just that it's very deadly. We don't even know what Toga's power is, the blood girl. You know, they mentioned, like, make sure you get several different things of blood back with you. Like, they've teased a lot of these things out there. And I truly and firmly believe something bad is going to happen to All Might in the process of this conflict.
I agree.
Because if anything is going to put Bakugo on the wrong path, it's going to be something bad happening to All Might. And I think that the stage is set for it to happen. There are traitors within the academy we know. We are pretty sure. There's also pretty sure a traitor within Class A, who could very easily still be in this scene interacting with things. Because
the Invisible Girl.
That's actually the high suspect everyone has. The Invisible Girl is the betrayer of that group. So there's definitely a big potential.
You can't trust somebody whose eyes you can't see. You hide the eyes, you hide the lies.
Yeah, like
as Mr. T would say.
So I think there's a big villain turnabout coming in the future. Now, if this was just the end of the arc, it'd be like, this was kind of a waste of time. Like, why kidnap Bakugo if you rescued him in 2 chapters and beat the villains? That would be kind of lame, but I'm 100% positive at this point that it's not going to just end that way. There's too many things still in motion for it to go that way. And I feel like this is a cool moment for the heroes to have, and then in time we're going to start seeing that the villains are they're not done yet.
Yeah, I agree.
A couple brief notes about Nisuka. Shinjuke ran away to America to be with her mother. Raku and Onodera followed her there, because things are unresolved between them. And got news that apparently Nisuko is going to be ending within like a month. Like, officially. It's got something like 3 chapters of Beyond This or something like that. Which we've kind of been expecting to happen to come for a while now, like the big conclusion. But it is notable that, you know, we actually have official word that apparently it is going to be ending in a few weeks.
It makes sense if you closed off every other plot line besides the 2 main girls.
Yeah.
What else are you really going to do? So It's a bummer, though, because I don't talk about New Sequoia every week, but it's an enjoyable series. I certainly enjoy it more than many other harem series I've read before.
Yep.
But, we'll look forward to those 3 chapters. I'm sure we'll do something when it does its final chapter, too. Unless Onodera ends up being the girl, because fuck Onodera.
Right. Because then it'd be just like, no!
Then I'm just like, why did I read this horseshit?
Else was wrong!
Yes. You guys will do something, but it'll just be rage-fueled.
Yeah. Harry should have ended up with Hermione!
Wrong! He should have ended up with that smart girl from Ravenclaw!
She wasn't pretty smart.
Yeah, she was it's the smart group.
Ravenclaw! Come on!
Yeah, come on, Nick!
Honestly, I think that Luna would have been a better fit for him than Ginny.
Then put a ring on it, Nick. It's bro code number one.
Wait, is there a name for these ships? Should we look this up?
I'm sure there...
I think that Harry Potter shipping just go by, like, initials, honestly, though.
I'm finding out.
So I think that it...
Harry Potter pairing names.
Oh, good.
Red and Brains is apparently the Hermione-Arthur Weasley pairing.
Okay, wait, seriously, there are like 500 characters in Harry Potter that are probably put into ships.
All right, hold on. Wait, you want to know Luna and Harry? What is it called? It's called Loonies and Lions.
So all of these are like blank and blank?
No, not all of them. Like Luna and Draco is called Frozen Moonlight.
What the fuck? All right, that's enough of that. All right. One Piece, chapter 823. The world is restless. Who the fuck is this character? It's on
the cover, it's Hercules, the guy who trained Usopp on the Island of Bugs.
Oh, okay.
Or Heracles, whatever you want to call him.
Alright, so...
He's flying around on what I think is an enormous Hercules beetle, because those look like... those are definitely clouds beneath them. I guess this is just a shadow is cast by it. I thought those were islands, but it still looks fucking enormous.
So we open in the Kingdom of Alabasta as Princess Vivi is sitting off and everyone is, you know, gathered and, you know, cheering and, you know, seeing her off and so on and so forth. And Vivi is really excited to be sitting off. She's, like, posing on the crow's nest and stuff like that. And apparently Hina's naval company, I guess, is there to escort her.
I don't want to turn this off on a tangent. I was just looking for more of the names here. And there's one I have to just note this. Apparently, the Harry Potter Lord Voldemort ship is just called... It's just like fucking the Cobra, like...
So what's your ship?
This seems like it might be a joke list, honestly.
I mean, this is off of fanlore.org. Where else is... Where
else am I supposed to go? That very official site. There's a bunch of, like, catching up with some characters that we haven't seen in a long time. Like, Cobra is there, looking a little bit older and worse for wear than the last time.
Yeah, it's been a rough 2 years for him.
Yeah. And, he's also, you know, coughing and so on and so forth. He's, like, playing up his sickness, like, oh, Amanas, if only my daughter would find a husband. I've got all these pictures of suitors for you. And she's like, nope.
Oh, it's funny. It's a pretty good joke.
And we go around seeing a lot of various royals, like the Queen of Goa, Sally Isn't Toinette. Which I think is a joke.
I didn't notice that before. That's great.
Isn't one Ed. Oh, boy. Let's see. Basically, we get introductions like, yes, you know, this is, you know, the countries of the world are in a restless state due to an event that happens once every 4 years in the holy land of Mary Joa, in the center of the world, the Reverie. Here, at the very highest of conferences, the monarchs of 50 nations will come together to discuss and debate the world's most serious topics and agree upon a shared direction of the future.
I'm concerned about this, Nick. Because we get glimpses to a lot of different characters, including one man who has a clock for a chin, who I'm already asked. Yeah, I want him to be a Straw Hat. But we've seen in the past, particularly when it comes to the, what do they call themselves? The Gorosei, the five leaders, essentially, of the world government. Those characters are all heavily influenced and inspired by real political figures. And you'll notice, looking through this cast here, there's one dude with a very pronounced Hitler mustache. I'm like, I hope that is the only similarity he has with Hitler.
Well, there's also a guy with a very, very racist-looking Fu Manchu who's got a dragon tattooed onto his head, so...
Well, here's my hope, is that I'm about to learn about some really cool real-life figure who has a fucking clock for a chin.
And, it's also fucking... What was his name?
Wapple.
Wapple is apparently going there from the evil Black Drum Kingdom.
Wait, when did he become evil?
What do you mean, when?
Well, he turned over... He was a toy maker.
But he was super corrupt and rich.
Huh. I must have missed when that change happened. Or I forgot about it.
Well, he was celebrating being rich and stuff, but...
Yeah, but he was making toys for kids. He was a hero, Nick. He was the Steve Jobs of this of that world.
He was a job builder. What's her face? Chopper's teacher.
Korea. And King Dalton of the real Drum Kingdom.
Yeah. And they're apparently going to be heading off there as well. And also, the ones that we have spent the most time having not seen. Viola and Rebecca are apparently going to go there as well.
As well as King Bartholomew, I think is his name, or something like that.
Something like that.
It's tough because there was Bartolomeo in the same one, and then there's Bartholomew Kuma. It's something along those. Or no, it's King Elizabello. Elizabello, yeah, that's what it is.
Yes.
And then King Riku, Princess Shirohoshi.
They also make a mention of how Don Xinjiao and Sai haven't returned to the Kano Kingdom, and so that's why Fu Manchu Guy is going to go in their stead. Then Shirohoshi, who gets her own giant 2-page spread for some reason. I guess because she's just a giant nerd girl thing.
Well, she is actually supposed to be an important character. She's one of the weapons of the war. One of the things in the Palmograph. She's Pluton, I think it is, or something like that. So she's supposed to be a pretty significant character, by and large, in the lore of the world.
And Neptune and her brothers are discussing, like, whether or not they should, you know, go. And she's like, well, I can't go. You know, Luffy said that he would return and then he would take me up to the surface and stuff. I'm scared to go. And but there's a whole bunch of, like, you know, think of what, you know, her mother would want, you know, and so on and so forth. Disagreement between them.
Yeah.
So after we've cut around the whole world, we get to Luffy's group on the Sunny Go, or the Thousand Sunny. And, Chopper and Nami and Brook are all still like, I can't believe we're not dead after being so tough. So, and Luffy's like, come on, guys, we gotta go guide the ship. And now he's like, yeah, steer a little bit more that way. You mean like this? No, a little the other way. Okay. Oh, God. Carrot has managed to somehow sneak aboard. I'm not really sure exactly how.
Her hat's cute, though, Nick.
She does have a stupid hat on, yes.
Stupidly cute.
It would look way stupider if her ears weren't sticking out of it.
That's what makes stupid cute.
I agree. That's like the only saving grace of it is that her ears sticking out, honestly. Because that's a stupid hat. And everyone's like, what are you doing here? And she's like, I decided to come along. And then she starts, you know, and then she nods on Brooke.
She goes to everybody. She does her little glomp thing with everybody. Mm-hmm. And just like when she gets to Brooke, she's like, ow, you're hard! Because she starts biting and licking people.
Yeah. And she's like, please, please let me come. Come on, guys. I brought my lunch, which is a carrot. Juice, which is a carrot. Snack, which is a carrot. Extra clothes.
Not many carrots yet.
Yeah. She only brought, like, 2 carrots and a bottle of carrot juice and clothes. And Peckums is like, how long do you think that's going to last you? Oh, you know, half a day. I mean, the sea's a big place, right? Well, yeah, it's going to take several days, though. Oh, wow, the ocean is a wonderland. Well, it's actually sea. It's not land at all.
I love how loud her exclamations are, too, because we pull away from the boat and it just starts being like, it takes multiple days to get places?
Oh, good. And Luffy's like, oh, it's okay, you're on board now, I guess, so, you know, can you just, you know, fight if we get into trouble? He's jogging into her character, she's like, who said you could eat those? Oh, and he's, like, biting into his neck, trying to kill him.
Fucking flying missiles out of nowhere, and just starts ripping his goddamn throat out.
She's got those blank eyes. Jesus Christ! And then 2 panels later,
well, he pets her on the head. She immediately calms down.
She looks super cute in that panel.
And they're like, well, I guess she'll be okay fighting on her own.
I don't want to always do it, Nick, but if she joined the Straw Hats, I think I'd be pretty cool with it.
This chapter.
The God King guy, who knows? He might be awesome. This character, she's endeared me to already. Plus, she doesn't look like Nami, which is a big plus in her life.
Honestly, yeah. You know, she's got roughly the same body type, but her face is very different from Nami's because of her rabbit features.
Yes.
Nami offers to cook for $5,000 a person. And then Pedro gets the newspaper, and he's like, what does all this stuff mean? Long-rumored mystery location discovered after decades. Baltigo, HQ of the Revolutionary Army, utterly in ruin. Huh.
That's
interesting.
That's huge.
The Revolutionary Headquarters has been discovered, apparently.
Well, we knew it got discovered, because we knew Jesus,
destroyed
Jesus followed them there, and then called in Blackbeard. Mm-hmm. So, this implies, or at least suggests, and, you know, the true story's not out, that Blackbeard and his crew were able to defeat Dragon and his army.
Well, not necessarily.
It's not necessarily the case.
Has Whitebeard's earthquake powers. Maybe he was just like,
it's very,
okay, let's go.
It's very possible that is the case, but the impression, at least on here, is like, holy shit, Blackbeard succeeded against them. Like, it's just another one of those, like, notches in this dude's fucking enormous belt where it's like, holy crap, this dude is really kicking everybody's ass when it comes to... He'll get the shit beat out of him for a while, and somehow that dude pulls it out at the end. I don't know how, but I'm excited. That's huge. Like, that... I was kind of interested to see where that was going to go, but it's dropped here at the end of the chapter in, like, a very intriguing way of, like, oh, hey, fucking revolutionaries are gone. Maybe, like, I don't know where they're going.
I don't think that that's the case, because...
But who knows where they're going
to
be.
If they were, like, captured or killed, that would be the headline, as opposed to their headquarters was discovered and destroyed.
Yeah.
So. Okay. So.
Very good.
Let's move on to Toriko. The one where Jiro gets the fuck beat out of him.
Yeah,
I may have to, like, mute for a little bit. It's so sad. I don't want to go through it again.
Gourmet 367, those tears. Last time Acacia showed up after Jiro had wrecked house, and he punched Jiro's head off. But then his head fades away, and he starts knocking the fuck out of Acacia. Knocks him in the temple, and then just... knocking everywhere, is moving so fast that, like, multiple copies of himself are appearing, and so Jiro's just like, oh, you know, I figured that I would use this bead here. I just, you know, snatched with him off of one of those food spirits, you know, and, you know, so I decided to, you know, snatch with those beads, because they were shattering whatever I was killing them. And yeah, it looks like that was a good idea, because it took all the damage in my place, so...
Yeah.
But he says, you know, Acacia, I've made it so only your mouth can still move, so tell me one thing. When Froze died, the tears you cried, were they real? Was the time we all spent together real? And Acacia just goes, Jiro, you come over here. I want to whisper it in your ear, but I'm totally not going to bite your ear off while I tell you this. The Blue Nitro, who is observing, is just like, I could attack Jiro, but I don't want Acacia to see the can that I have. Because that's the backup option if things go crazy. So I will just wait. And Acacia, you know, is just like, oh, come here and I'll tell you, Jiro. And Jiro's going to demand, was it real or was it fake? Answer me.
And an awesome panel, like... Seriously, it's not a full-page spread, but it has all the impact of one where it's just drawn with so much detail and so much anger in his face.
So Acacia is like, you know, you always were a few cards short of a deck. Maybe it was because you were raised by animals. You lack wisdom. You should never have left my mouth free. And he sticks his tongue out like Midora and starts knocking himself all across his body, and undoes the million knocking that's paralyzing him. But Jiro's like, oh, that's alright. I already saw this coming. So, as for your answer to my question, he starts to punch the ground, and he's like, I'll listen to it in the afterlife! Grand knocking! And Neo's mouth appears around his fist, nope. And eats the impact. And he's like, what the fuck? There's enough power in this to stop the rotation of the Earth, and you ate it? And... a tentacle sticks its way into Jiro's mouth, which is creepy. And he says, well, I'm the one who taught you all your moves. and he declares damage knocking release. And he explains, you know, whenever you're injured, you use knocking to stop the damage. But that doesn't mean that the damage has disappeared. It's only paused within you, still alive as ever. All the damage you've stored up in your body over the course of your life has been released. Tell me, what happens now? And it's like he's been punched super fucking hard in the face. And so, you know, Jiro is like, his body is getting impacted over and over again by, you know, dozens of years of damage he's taken over his lifetime. He's trying to knock it out as it's appearing on him. And Acacius just says, nah, it's too late. There's probably enough damage in you to destroy several Earths, and you're being assaulted by it all in one go. Jiro, being the second oldest, you were uninhibited and full of yourself. Up to the very end, you gave your old man a hard time. This is goodbye, Jiro. Oh, as for the answer to your question, those tears were fake. And Jiro starts to disintegrate with all these impacts to his body, and he begs him as he's dying, don't tell that to Midora, because he believes in you even now. He believes that those times that shine like gold were real, even now and forevermore. And he's frickin' disintegrated in the mid-air. There is still
he
more.
He dead as shit.
There is still more in this chapter, but this was a really, really cool finish to this fight.
It's
this was so good.
It's one of the biggest tragedies I think we've seen in Jump, especially in recent memory, because generally when a character dies, there's some kind of sweetness to it, but there's none at all for Jiro. He dies in horrific pain, having been told that everything he believed up to this point about his family was a lie, and he just it's the fact he dies horrifically, painfully, just explodes, and is taunted the entire way through for a character who we've known pretty much since the beginning of this series. You're like,
he was one of the first really strong characters we were introduced to, because he showed up in like the Century Soup storyline.
And it's effective storytelling because, you know, he possibly could have won this encounter, but he let his, you know, his humanity, his desire to get an answer for, you know, his father's actions caused him to make a misstep and have the turnabout dawn onto him. And it's just sad. It's like a really big, kind of sad, awful moment where you're like, oh, wow, this is the way this dude dies. Like, even, what was the first brother's name? The president,
Ichiryu.
Yeah, even he had a bit more of, like, a positive death, because it was, like, a moment where he kind of connected with Midoriya and had sort
you
of
keep
those
saying Midoriya whenever you say whenever you mean Midora. You can't Midora. Stop saying it.
I forget which ones, because there's Midoriya as someone else, but
in World Trigger.
Yeah. Or I thought it was in My Hero. Whatever.
My Hero.
Okay. Regardless, Midora had like a connection with him, and that's the way that guy died. So it's, you know, tragic, but there's still like a sweet moment to it. This is just pure and abject, like this dude got fucked and had no joy in his life when he died. It was just pure and utter agony. It's really sad and tragic. It's not a heroic death. It's not like he saved somebody. He just lost.
I know Neo and I guess Acacia are like the big bad guys and whatever for this series, but I mean, I always kind of felt like, yeah, they're going to be the big bad guys, whatever. You know, like, I see them as a threat, but I don't really hate them because I don't see a reason to, you know? But now it's just like, oh, fuck you, Acacia. Fuck you. I cannot wait to see your ass handed to you because this is terrible. You're a terrible person.
Neo is still a super lame villain, but Acacia, this really made him as the villain for me.
Mm-hmm. And also,
Neo, still lame as shit. Acacia, oh.
Oh, Acacia. I hate this guy. I hate him so much now. I hate him more than Nina Mia.
That's a lot of hate.
And he's actually done stuff to deserve it.
I think everything Nina Mia has done has been justified in its own way.
Oh, boy. Anyway, in the conclusion of the chapter, we get this, you know, narration says, you know, an echo that sounded like a howl was heard all across the world except in one place, which is where Joey and Midora are still fighting. And Joey kind of concedes defeat to Midora in terms of fighting. like, you're superior to me in skill and speed and power, and I'm not so sure a creature exists in this world that can beat you. But as far as cooking is concerned, I'm at an advantage. Midora's like, all right, come at me.
Whatever.
He essentially replies with that one famous panel from One Punch Man where Saitama goes, okay.
Yeah.
Joey brandishes the knife and says, I'll make this fight the one taste that will be burnt into your memories, Midora. A bitter taste! Okay, seriously, I just saw Acacia murder the fuck out of Jiro, so you're gonna have to bring a bit more in that for me to...
She's like, but I took off my poofy shirt!
You can tell that I have tits now!
I have a threat now. My poofy shirt's gone.
Alright, and that was it for Toriko. A very good chapter. Welcome. It was a return to form I failed for the series.
It was tragic, Nick. Very, very tragic.
Alright. It's time for World Trigger. Chapter 140, Tamakoma 2, Part 11. I'm almost out of water, but we've got a voice act through this one.
Yeah. So, what? Well, we're doing special recap again, in case you're just tuning in. This is the first episode you've ever listened to, which is very possible. You know, Stan Lee said every comic book is somebody's first. So, if you're not sure what's happening, we're doing comedy-centric stuff this month in April, and we thought it'd be fun with... Each week we take one series, we do a recap where we read through it, you know, verbatim through the character dialogue, and we have a random voice generator full of celebrity and cartoon and just goofy impressions that will be randomly propped up that we then use as the voice of the characters throughout it. So it's going to be a very, you could say in some ways, very dishonorable way to honor the series by making jokes and belittling all the characters, but it's going to be fun.
We've got a lot of characters who talk in this one. I think it's like 17 or 18 people. Because I'm pretty sure everyone in the Rank Wars match talks at some point. There are three commentators as well. Then there are Husei and Jin and Yotaro watching at home. Kitora in a flashback. God damn it!
That's a lot.
Let's do
it. But we have three people here this week.
One who says she can't do impressions.
You can try. At the very least, you're a Foley person.
Right. So start us off with that, because there's explosions and stuff going off.
Dum, 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 dum.
All right. First is Kakizaki.
Are you okay?
Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, he's Scooby-Doo.
So then there's Tarotaro and Fumika from his squad. I guess we could do one voice for both of them, because I don't think that either of them talk very much.
All right, Nick, how about this one? Luna from Sailor Moon.
Yeah!
Dud, dud. Rattle, rattle.
Katori.
No, first it's the...
It's Katori, and then it's Wakamura.
Yeah.
Katori asks the question, Wakamura answers.
Right. Yeah.
But someone says you don't know about... Oh, I guess that happens first, just for the panel play. Okay, I get it. So Katori is...
Come on, Chris. Right to left.
Well, if you go by right to left, then his panel's first.
It's top
no,
it isn't.
Right.
Yes, it is. It's down there. Look at it. If you go furthest to the right, his panel will be first, because that's...
Oh,
the
my God,
speech.
Chris.
But I'm being as fucking pedantic as possible right now. All right, so he's Miss Piggy.
And who is Katori, then?
Hold on a second. I accidentally clicked reload, so I had to grab my...
God damn it, Chris.
Again. You got me so upset! Hold on here. All right, we're going to pull this back.
We are professional.
Yeah, well, the random generator has issues sometimes when you accidentally delete everything. You can't do that person. I don't think I can even do that person. Ah, Joey Wheeler!
Alright.
You don't know about these! Oh, wait, no, sorry, you're first. Just had, like, a conversation! Alright, do you want Katori to be Miss Pinky then, or...?
Uh...
What fits her more, Joey Wheeler or Miss Piggy?
Honestly, Miss Piggy fits her better.
Okay.
Because she's such a, you know, snobby, arrogant, you know.
But I only know how to do nice Miss Piggy, so that's where we're going. What's going on?
You don't know about this? It's Tamakoma's cannon.
Blam! Boom! Blam again! Boom!
All right. It's Sakurako, the announcer.
Ooh, alright, this one's good. I think this is you, though.
Character.
What's that?
It's going to be a lot of lines for this character.
I think only you're going to be able to do this one, though, Nick. Name that came up? The Cinema Snob.
God, if only Skitch were here. That man does the best Brad impression. Alright, hang on a second. Oh, it's not going to be good. So many lines, guys. Tamakoma 2 opens fire. It appears that rather than rushing to get points directly, they're destroying the buildings and forcing their opponents to come out.
You nailed that one. I don't think you need to feel bad about that.
Tokieda.
Oh, it's difficult. What? No. It's difficult. It's definitely difficult to hit them only with radar only. I bet their goal was to remove all the obstacles and then snipe them using the Egret. Egret? Egret? What? No. What?
Not sure he did that on purpose or not. Okay. And then, of course, it is Izumi.
Do you want to do Donald Trump again? He came up, and I can do again.
Let's do someone else.
Shaggy from Scooby-Doo?
She's probably using lead bullet, though, because she can't shoot people. We're sitting ducks out here.
I know already. Oh, that's not Miss Piggy at all. Okay, I know already. We gotta do something about that meeting.
You're a frog.
You're a frog. And then we need one for this dude. God damn. Donald Trump wants to come up on this all the time. All right, John Kennedy. John F. Kennedy.
What? After all these shots, Amatori's position is obvious to him. Oh, no, wait, that's the announcer. Oh, bot?
Bot? Hurrah!
Hiya! Sakurako again. After all these shots, Amatori's position is obvious to everyone. However, in order to take out Amatori, they have to jump into Tamakoma 2's spider web. Yeah.
Shaggy?
They're going to drag you in there no matter what, dude. If things get worse, they may even blow out the entire map except for the wired area.
Alright. So, I'm giving this one to Annalisa. I need your best Snagglepuss.
What?
God. Oh, exit stage left even. Heavens to Murgatroyd. That's all you have to do.
Oh, God.
She has one line here.
She's got two lines.
There's two. You before you.
The cat's saying what a prodigy.
Okay, wait, give me an example of Snugglepuss again.
Exit stage left even. Heavens to Murgatroyd.
That's Chicago for you. What a prodigy.
See? I think you did fine there.
A genius, even. All right. Sakurako again. Tamakoma 2 has a long-range advantage with the only sniper here. And with their wire techniques, they're even stronger. How will the other two squads deal with this situation?
Who is this guy again?
That's Kakizaki.
No, I know, but who's his voice?
He's the first one.
That was a while ago. It feels like that was ages ago, Nick.
I know.
Oh, shit. We did him, like, real quick, too.
Come on, chat room. You gotta remind us.
Scooby-Doo. Oh, that's right. He's fucking Scooby-Doo. Spread out. We're gonna get tired if we spread together, Shaggy.
So bad.
Ray!
Oh, God. Yotaro. Or, wait, wait.
No, we have that.
Oh, no, there's a guy. There's a guy. Yeah. Oh, Kakizaki Squad. What was... Because he did, like, one...
We have one for both of them. Was
yeah,
he...
Yeah, for both of them.
Was he John F. Kennedy? No.
No.
Fuck it, he's Marlon Brando for this one line.
What do we do now?
Hit that pivot a little bit longer. The Tiger Squad's gonna make the move.
Alright, Yotaro.
Alright, he's going to be... Not the cinema snob. not Scooby-Doo for the seventh time. Kaiba. Alright.
Take that! Nice one! See the power of Tamakoma 2.
Oh, Jenna has a line here.
Yes, he does. And then you say.
It wouldn't be one without him. Oh, so far, it's looking good!
Oh,
yes! You say it's Benzai!
It's true they've got momentum, but they're attracted to my attention!
Oh, now they're opponents know who to target! Oh, I need to use the bathroom, though. I had a Taco Bell tortilla shell, and now I need to poop my brains out. Alright, now they're analyst here. Alright, boy, we can do this one. Take down Tamakoma's sniper. We'll move in with Kakizaki Squad.
That's still you, because it's
being... Oh, that's right. Cooperating with Kakizaki Squad?
I got this.
Hey, Rocky, if both squads go in at once, Tamakoma will only have two choices. Focus their power on one side or the other, or split their forces to fight both. Either way, if we can be on the side that Kuga isn't on, we can put pressure on their sniper. Presto!
So we'll be using the advantage of numbers.
Are you sure?
He needs to stop. He just always says but.
Are you sure Kakizaki Squad is going to move like that?
He can take over Bullwinkle again.
They're probably waiting for us to go in. At this rate, Tamakoma is going to dominate the game. And that's the last thing Kakizaki wants unless he's given up already. Why are they waiting for us? It's hard to get into Miss Piggy that quickly. Kirby, why are they waiting on us? They can just move in on their own. Well, that's because whoever tries to attack first is very likely going to get pushed back first. Most likely by Kuga. I see. They're just using us as a decoy. That pisses me off!
One line from Kakizaki Squad's operator.
Great. She gets my awesome Terrence Howard impersonation.
What?
Oh, Katara Squad's activated the bagworm!
One is two!
Next time I'll be Iron Man! Or I'll ask for too much money then talk about crystals and beating my wife on a podcast!
Oh, what a weird fucking dude. Alright, so that is, okay. Oh, fuck. I forgot again who the hell
he's, Joey Wheeler, isn't he?
No, Kakizaki Squad.
Oh,
because we've changed them, like, three times.
We made a Marlon Brando this time, I think.
All right.
They're on the move.
Good! Elizabeth, let go in!
All right, it's time for Chica's first line. And then Osamu and Yuma, Yuma right after.
I keep getting, like, the same three voices. Like, but just
eat them off the list!
I did before! And then I hit refresh, and I didn't have the time to go through. Oh, Ivan, there's movement from Katori Squad on the left and Kakizaki Squad on the left. It's all getting... Ivan, it's all over. It's over the place. It's all... It's what Ivan... All right.
Let's make one of these voices you and one of them me, and then we'll do both voices at once for Roger that. How's that?
All right. So, we'll go through here. All right. Yuma can be Michael Caine. And Osamu will be Jar Jar Binks.
Oh, God. Only the most dignified of voices for Tamakoma 2's captain. All right. Can you do Jar Jar?
Yeah, I can do Jar Jar. Hold on. Misa, okay.
Okay, ready?
One, two, three. Rotten Dent!
It's going to come out sounding terrible, I'm sure. Alright. Both Katori and Kakizaki squads have activated their bagworms. They're splitting up and moving in. Their target is most likely Tamakoma's rampaging cannon Amatori. I've forgotten who we did, who we made Tsuki and Izumi.
Was he... Yeah, let me just check this out real quick.
I've been writing them down, but only after a certain point.
He's not... No, Shaggy. He's Shaggy.
Oh, right. Okay. They've gone too far and made themselves the main target.
But Tamakoma's goal is to trap their enemies in the wires. It's all going according to their plan. The other squads appear to be working together. What will Tamakoma 2 do next? What? I feel like there haven't been enough Foleys. You need to start adding them in even if they're not there. Like, you do their Foley for them being hurt. And do it to Snagglepuss and, Sean Connery.
Oh, God. Hang on. Yeah, there we go.
Clang. Jump. Pa. That's like the sound, okay?
You're on this side? Which side was wrong then?
Want me to go for the sniper?
No, the other side must be lightly guarded. Let Katori squad deal with her sniper. It'll take all of us to go up against Kuka.
We have four eyes on this side! How lucky! Finish him off quickly, and we'll head to the cannon next!
I think this is still.
I think that this. No, because every time it's Sakurako.
Yeah, that's right.
Tamakoma 2 has split up on two sides. Now we have 2 3-on-1 battles here.
Amatori's position can let her cover both sides. It's practically 3-for-1 with 2 for both. Wait, what? No!
Perhaps. Someone should really head off now and head off Amatori. It's one heck of a struggle to have a sniper in this position. Do you think Kakizaki squad is waiting for Katori squad to break through?
Well, it's tough to handle for Koga for sure, since Captain uses the media. They'll be able to blow away the wires along with the buildings, as long as there's no sniper fire. I think that, realistically, what they should do now is have Katori's squad defeat Amatori, or something like that.
I see. Katori's squad isn't sending anyone to take down Amatori. Does that mean they think that it won't take that long to break through? Nobody's out of the game at this point. This will be a fight to see which team has the best collective strength. This is where the fun begins!
Slash, slash, duck, duck. Queen!
It's like they're going through, like, a fucking... It's like they're hacking their way through a jungle. It's kind of great. Alright, it's time for Kitora's one-chapter-only voice.
I'll probably take on doing it, because I can't make you do this voice after just doing Cinema Snob. Because... Yeah. Our voice for Kitor is the Christian Bale Batman.
That's not a bad voice for her, honestly.
let me just take a quick sip here.
No, totally understandable.
You need to be able to create a number of allies for these zones on up. But you understand why? It means that even if you are there, even if you're taking down first, there's still a way to talk to your squad.
Oh, Misa, thank you, Kitora!
Now Misa can fight without any hesitation!
Sorry, Gakizaki. I'm taking 3 points.
Well, it's an extra. Show me what you've got, Rocky!
Oh, God.
Do you still ship Osamu and Kitaro with those voices?
I ship Jar Jar Binks and Christian Bale Batman so much more now.
Well, I've kind of forgotten how I thought about the chapter originally now. honestly, this is cool. It is very, it's so different and very refreshing to see Tamakoma 2 in complete control of the battle like this. Yeah. It's, I mean, more than just like, oh, they won or lost in the end, seeing how well their team is coming together, the fact that they're basically forcing both other teams to team up on them because they view them as such a threat is probably says more about the leaps and bounds that they've made than what the end results of the match might be.
It's just super refreshing for Osamu to be in a fight and be confident. Like, he doesn't seem worried. There's very likely some kind of plan in place here. Or maybe he is like, I'm just going to delay them a bit. I might get taken out, or maybe I'll survive, but I'll have to leave the fight because it's all about Kuga getting the points. But and I'd be perfectly happy if that is just the way it goes, because he's confident going into this and he's made a difference in the battle already.
It's such a difference from the last battle where he was like, well, I got to get points. Now he's like, no, I see.
Yeah, I know what I can do to help.
So refreshing. I'm so proud, Osamu. I'm so proud.
I'd be happy if he, you know, had to leave or if he even lost here because he still showed himself. But God, do I want a moment where fucking Katori's like, fuck it, I'm going after the sniper. Bolts forward and Osamu's just like, oh, bitch had a hound over there.
That is my short-term dream.
Ever. Like, just fucking blasts her right through her head, too. Like, just don't even give her time to, like, utter out, like, one douchey comment on the way out. Like, your glasses suck! Nothing. Just knocks her right out.
Alright. Oh, guys. That is gonna do it. That's our recap all done with. So it's time to give out some awards. Favorite series of the week and weekly MVP.
Yes.
And my series of the week is going to go to Toriko. Was a freaking heartbreaking sequence, but it had a big, you know, impact on me, and I thought it was just a very well-executed conclusion to this very short fight, actually, between Akashi and Jiro. But all, you know, it all fits together. The reason why Akashi was able to win is because Jiro showed emotional weakness, and because of the way Jiro's techniques work, and he exploited that because he knows him so well. It's a very well-executed little sequence. So, Turco, my favorite series this week.
Oh, Lisa?
I'm going to agree. Turco is my series of the week. Even though Song was so good at this.
I'm like, World Trigger and Black Clover had such great chapters.
I know, but it's such... Like, I felt that Turco has kind of been dragging for a long time. And this chapter is just... It's the one that made me finally kind of sit up and be like, oh, shit. Shit. Oh, yeah, I guess this stuff is really bad. It was just... Yeah, it was a good chapter. Rest in peace, Jiro. Rest in peace.
And, Chris?
I'll be the one odd man out here, then, and I'm giving my chapter of the week to My Hero Academia. I think it was a really cool chapter. I think that I like the big, like, all the heroes, we get to see them in action. You're like, holy shit, these guys are fucking... astonishing. Like, this is why they're the top-ranked heroes, because they fucking effortlessly put that plan into place. So, I'm pretty ecstatic for where that's going to go, and it's just an awesome chapter in and of itself.
And our audience chose World Trigger this week. But yay! Honestly, like, World Trigger, My Hero Academia, Food Wars, Toriko, I thought all were really good this week.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a pretty good week overall in Jump, despite the fact that I started off the recap like, this one sucked, and this one, and this one too!
It's not a Jump, but it still was pretty bad.
It still counts. And my weekly MVP is going to be Acacia from Toriko for the same reason, because, I mean, I hate him, but you know, well done. You know, gotta, you know, have a villain that you want to see beaten. So, yeah.
My MVP. I wish I could choose three, but I'm gonna go with All Might. I want to choose all three of those heroes that burst through that door, but he's just so, like, oh, it makes me feel like, look, yes, he's so clearly the number one hero, you know? I thought he was really strong in this chapter. So
yeah, you know, he had a pretty good damn speech, too, as well, just along with the big rescue moment, too.
I'm giving mine to Jiro, because he had a great final moment, and he deserves it for that send-off. It's tragic, but it's compelling.
All right. So that is it for Wikimonger Recap. We want to thank everyone who joined us here on the show. We record on hitbox.tv/RoloT, normally Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, but sometimes we do need to change it up. So be sure to hit us up on Twitter so you can stay updated on all that kind of stuff. He is at RoloT. I'm at Y Ruler of Time. There's the @WMR official Twitter account where we do more official podcast news exclusively. And, of course, Annalisa can be followed at Kaito Ace.
Just use your keyboard. You can figure it out.
You can check out our past episodes on weeklymongerrecap.podbean.com as well as on iTunes. And, come on, guys, you know, get us back on that top 200 list. Come on, guys.
I believed. For a moment, I dreamed, and that was my mistake. We didn't get any new reviews. I think that's why we've dropped out of the top 200. Had somebody left us a review, we might have been up to 124, you know? We could have gone up.
124 and a half. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Well, we're always competing with another beer-crafty podcast.
All right. Send us criticism, ask us questions, suggest future manga for us to read, send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com, and we'll go through all that stuff. Special thanks also go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to do all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. This weekend, we're going to be doing a very special movie commentary as part of Comedy Month. You are not going to want to miss that. I believe we're going to probably do it on Sunday.
No, more than likely. And we'll let everybody know the movie we're doing, like, the day of, so you know, find it.
And special thanks go out to the guys who help us do the show. Steve Mann, our talk artist. You can check out his stuff at DeviantArt. And he's got a Patreon and a Tumblr. I think he's got two Tumblrs. He might have two DeviantArts. He's got a bunch of different things. And
he owns a small island in the Mediterranean Sea that he rules out of. It's a pretty cool place. You get to visit it.
And Infamous Planet as well, of course, made the frame that you see on the stream, and he's helped us out in a bunch of other ways as well. Thank you. So, Chris, what are we going to be reading for next time?
Well, I figure we're not going to have enough time in Comedy Month to get another series out there, more than likely. So I figure I'm already in the mood for it. Why don't we continue the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure? So we'll be taking a look next time at JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Part 2. Battle Tendency, I believe, is the name for it. This is the one with Joseph Joestar, the one that had the anime with Roundabout at the end. I think it's going to be a good one. This is, I think, where the series starts to really pick up and starts becoming the JoJo we all know and love. So, it should be fun.
Much longer part than part one was.
It's longer than that, but I don't remember it being much thicker of a read. You'll also get to see the cyborg Nazi hero who then gets to become Guile from Street Fighter.
There's some very interesting chapter styles I'm seeing along here. Alright, I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, that's going to be our next recommendation, so yeah, we're going to close off now.
Yeah, do we have a any kind of wacky line we want to go out on?
I don't know. We used a lot of wacky lines in the 3-hour show we just did.
It's not 3 hours yet. We still got a couple more minutes separating us. We got, we kill some time. We could do, 20 questions. Alright, I'm thinking of a person. Alright, go.
Is it Hitler?
Damn it. No. No, I got, you got a second person now. All right, now go.
Is it Hitler's son?
He didn't have a son. Ah, damn it, you got me! You got me again! I started thinking of people that didn't exist. No one likes playing with me. They're like, it's not a musician, an author, a musician. they do nothing. What are they? And I'm like, my imaginary son in the future. He's still an infant, though. They're like, I fucking hate you.
He would have known, though.
Yeah, this is why no one talks to you.
Oh, God.